The Off the Ball Podcast Network. OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
It's 7:30 on this Wednesday morning, and you're welcome along to OTB AM. It's Owen and Johnny Ward with you right the way through until 9:30. And what a show we have for you today. We've got Vladimir Klitschko from Lisbon in conversation with Ger Gilroy coming up later on. We've got Paddy Houlihan, who's in studio with me yesterday, talking about his new book, Hooligan, which is out now. It's a brilliant story. We sat down for about 30 minutes. We're bringing that interview later on. Kenny Cunningham will join us as well to sift through last night's Champions League action, because, Johnny, it was pretty good. Although I will say, at this point, when you see a 4-4 draw between two teams after switching over, you're like, well, of course it finished 4-4. Of course, that's how a Champions League night is supposed to end. Mm. Like, every midweek now, you turn on the TV and you're like, what?
Drama.
Like, a 3-3 draw or 3-2 ding-dong battle at this point will be a drab affair compared to what we've been used to in the calendar year of 2019.
Mm. Aspilicueta done again on the VAR, which was a lot of drama. And just talking to Phil Egan, just as before we came on there, just debating the merits of VAR at this stage and the fact that it's kind of a bit of a killjoy in that you're not sure whether to celebrate goals now, and you know, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? I'm actually turning against it, and I think a lot of people are.
It seems to be en vogue turning against VAR this week. Yourself, Phil Egan, Jamie Carragher, the holy trinity have all turned against VAR this week.
Yeah.
My favourite part about is, like, I'm a big fan of any goal that involves a massive celebration and then eventually it gets ruled out. But Cesar Azpilicueta actually took off his captain's armband and kissed it. While sliding towards the corner flag. It's one thing kissing the crest, but actually taking off the captain's armband and kissing that. Dude's like, I love my captaincy so much.
Yeah,
and
I love me captaincy.
Then it's taken off.
When he had a goal as well against Liverpool earlier in the season, I actually had bet Liverpool that day, so it was like, I was really overjoyed when it was disallowed. But, you know, the more it happens, you know, should we really be that worried about an inch or a centimetre here or there? I don't know. It rules out a lot of goals that shouldn't be given, but it is kind of spoiling the crack a bit, isn't it? And one of the match reports today made a good point as well, that VAR is to cater for the people watching on TV a bit more so than the people at the ground. So people in Stamford Bridge were kind of in the dark as to what was happening.
That's have you been to a game of VAR yet?
No. It kind of reminds me of Rory O'Connor put up a tweet the day of the hurling final in relation to the controversial red card, obviously, of Richie Hogan, and nobody in the ground could really know what was going on. So everybody was on their phones texting. So that's kind of, I suppose that's a debate about the organic nature and the beautiful natural thing of going to a game and not exactly knowing everything. But, you know, the audience at home is what matters now, really, unfortunately. It's not the people who are paying in. And I haven't been to a game with VAR there, but I don't know. I don't know what you think. I'm kind of coming down against it, though. I think it's taking the joy out of it a bit.
It is ruining games, and you would like to think that the technology gets improved or the use of the technology gets improved. That's what I mean. Actually, the technology seems to be fine. It's just how much they're using it, when they're using it, and exactly what the definitions are for some of the rules. Mm. Outside of that 12 minutes where I kind of did the stupid thing of switching over to Liverpool Genk, I actually didn't see any of the remaining 78 minutes of Liverpool Genk last night. You were watching it?
Yeah, you know, I think the general consensus is they didn't really get out of second gear. They've stumbled a bit through the group, but bigger tests lie ahead. I've said for about 6 weeks now, I don't think Liverpool are actually playing that well, but they keep eking out results. So you can look at this as a good or a bad thing. You know, I thought that the hole they got themselves into in Villa to get out of that was really laudable, but I think there are certainly doubts about their form, some of their players, Salah in particular. You know, I think Man City is going to be a huge test for him. This is a really, really, I know six-pointers and all that, but this is an enormously big game for Liverpool, because City have a better goal difference, and I think they probably will have a better goal difference at the end of the season. Victory for City very much puts it back into their hands, and they're still, to my mind, they're still favourites over Liverpool, because I think they've been more convincing, despite not being entirely convincing themselves, particularly defensively. But
why do you say that? What is it about Manchester City that convinces you more than Liverpool?
It's probably the calibre of players they have, and, you know, the fact that they really haven't. To me, they really haven't gotten going yet. Whereas with Liverpool, you're looking at
Like Salah hasn't gotten going yet, if we're using that logic.
Salah didn't have a good season last season, to my mind, in comparison to what he's capable of. And time again, attacks break down because of Salah. Either he's a little bit greedy, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but at times he takes the wrong option. But to me, he kind of looks like his pace isn't what it was either. And if we go back to the start of last season, where Salah effectively didn't have a... Salah's had very little breaks. I'd love to know what time off Salah's had, like, since the start of 2.5 seasons ago, or 2 and a bit seasons ago, because obviously in action for his country. And again, in the off season, he didn't have much of a break. And to me, I just wonder how long he's going to hold his place. Liverpool, they're not laden. Like, Origi was okay last night. They're not laden with replacements for him. But to my mind, of the three, that holy trinity up front, he's definitely the least. He's definitely the most vulnerable to being dropped at the moment. Anyway, I think he's 5 goals in the league this season from 10 games, which is okay. But his record against the big teams last season was poor. You know, he really, you know, most of the big games he didn't play that well.
You think there's actually risk of him perhaps not being included in the first choice 11 at some point?
Absolutely, yeah.
Is the drop off not extraordinary between the starting front three and the rest? Of course, Origi can come in and be this cult hero when he's needed, when it is necessary for Origi to play some minutes. But it's never been in Jurgen Klopp's minds to actually rotate, I think, especially for the big game.
Not really. No, he'll definitely play the weekend. I think Charlie Nicholas kind of alluded to it at the weekend that he thought he was particularly poor against Villa, by all accounts. So I was only kind of half watching it here, but every time, just watch Salah, the amount of attacks that break down after he gets the ball. I think that's what's quite interesting. And again, there were flashes of brilliance last night as well, but to me, he's definitely not the... Like, the season he had 2 seasons ago was quite extraordinary, but I think he's quite a good bit off that level. And Sunday's going to be huge for Salah and huge for Liverpool as well, definitely, because they've limped through a lot of games where they've... And defensively as well, quite interesting, Owen. They're definitely not at the races defensively compared to where they're at. The high line is causing them problems. And Van Dijk played on the game player of the goal last night without it exactly being his fault, but there are definitely frailties there. Man City will see this as a great opportunity, I think.
Yeah, I'm just looking through the Charlie Nicholas quotes for anybody who's missed them. Liverpool are not at their best. People might suggest that once they get going, they will be ruthless, but they are getting away with it currently, he said. Napoli and Manchester United matches were reality checks, but they could have been 2 or 3 down by the time they rescued things at Villa. Then on Mo Salah, he says he was really average at the weekend, as was Roberto Firmino, so Jurgen Klopp may leave a couple out and change it up. It normally is Firmino who he rests, but I would leave him in with Mane and leave Salah out. He may not like it, but it needs to happen. So yeah, that's exactly what you're saying. I'm not sure if that... Like, I just think that the front three, Virgil van Dijk, Alisson, and Robertson, yeah, like Trent Alexander-Arnold, maybe not to the same level as Andy Robertson, are just undroppables at this point. And the front three are undroppable because of the quality behind them. Like, there is...
What quality in midfield, though? Do you know, the midfield is so functional that they're really reliant on that front three being at its best in those big games, because their midfield isn't world class, really, but they get away with it because the front three is...
That's
so
why we see a little bit more rotation. Granted, I know he's kind of got a bit more of a formula over the last few weeks.
Yeah.
But that's why we have seen rotation in that position, is because they just don't have a midfield three that is, by definition, world class, just like the front three is.
And also, they have to work so hard, and they've so many games that, like, rotation is fine. But I wonder, at some stage, does he think, you know, I can change this formation a bit and possibly play 2 up top and maybe add a bit of strength to midfield?
Well, that would be a drastic change.
It would. You can't really see it at the moment, but Salah's definitely not undroppable. I mean, he hasn't been undroppable. I thought he was lucky to be starting all of last season, because he's been so many games where he was 5-6 out of 10. And Liverpool fans seem to be a little bit blind to that. And maybe, you know, look to the extraordinary goal he got against Chelsea, and, you know, also the fact that he got that crucial goal against Napoli in the group stages. But most of the big games, he didn't do a lot. And that's totally indisputable. I'd have sympathy for Salah, because I think, like a lot of players now, he's basically plays too much football. A lot of players that play for the South American teams. This has been pointed out about Sanchez as well, that Sanchez like has been completely vilified in English football, but the argument's also been made. I remember one of the football correspondents from Europe on the show before that, like, he plays so much football that he's so little of a break. And I'd love to Mo Salah to actually tell people how much time off he's had from football over the last 2.5 years compared to your average sportsman.
Yeah, it's a good question. Let us know, Liverpool fans. You can tweet us at Off The Ball. Is Mo Salah's position in danger in the front three with Liverpool? We've got Kenny Cunningham coming up later on that. We've also, as I mentioned at the top of the show, got Paddy Houlihan, former UFC fighter with us and current Sinn Féin councillor. Of course, he was in studio with us yesterday. And here's what he said when I asked him what sort of fighter he was in the cage. Would you say you were an emotional fighter?
An emotional fighter?
Yeah.
Define emotion. What do you mean?
Angry, no. Wanting to not only defeat an opponent, defeat a man at the opposite end of the cage.
No, I was fighting myself, yeah. Most of the time, you know what I mean? It was me against me in there, when I'm looking in that mirror and stuff like that. Now, the opponent obviously matters and stuff, but the emotion part with me, wasn't it? It was pure bliss for me. It was just, it was like Elysium, the thing that Maximus talks about. It was a beautiful thing to me, you know, walking out. The idea of feeling the energy of the crowd. I couldn't think of like anger and I would say nerves is not as an emotion. Nerves is like a reaction to a situation that you're putting your body into and to go through that. And anyway, that's the decision. If I put you in the tree arena, you'll feel the exact same way I feel.
I was just about to say, that's my lack of understanding, referring to emotion as anger automatically, yeah. Which is a very, very different thing. That's the first thing that comes to my mind when you ask me what emotion is. But actually, it's very different. Like you say in the book, that being an emotional fighter is a very dangerous thing.
Yeah.
But separately to that, there is this almost spiritual feeling, I think, from reading your book, that you get that isn't the same as being fired up emotionally, overly emotionally.
No, I'm into it. Like I'm into it in a spiritual way. You know what I mean? When someone's hitting me and I'm taking it, I like it. You know what I mean? I like it. Now, I'm nervous going there.
Yeah.
But you would be as well. If we put you and me in the same situations, the difference between me and you would be how we react to them feelings, how we succumb to them feelings. If you're, no, I can't do it because of this, then you won't do it. Where to me, I was the opposite. I was like, no, I can do it because of this.
Yeah, Paddy Houlihan coming up after 9 o'clock this morning on OTB AM. We're going to get underway with the sports pages in just a moment now, and then the Champions League at 8 o'clock. Kenny Cunningham joining us shortly after it as well to give his analysis on last night's games. The sports news at 8:30 with Tom Malone, and then that interview with Vladimir Klitschko in Lisbon. Jerry was sitting down with him yesterday, is coming your way at 8:40. And then a Mayo GAA latest. There is a lot happening in Mayo Gaelic affairs at the moment, and we'll get into that at around 10 to 9.
I love the way it's like a Mayo GA latest. We just don't know what it's going to be because it's so mad up there at the moment. Social media stuff is interesting as well, isn't it? Like county board kind of having a snipe at people, like giving their up, which I kind of agree with in a way. But this is just rumbling on. They must be delighted in Galway because it takes the attention off the Galway county board as well.
There's something in the air on the western seaboard at the moment, it seems, with Clare having their own troubles as well, yeah. Before. Appointing Lohan. Paddy Houlihan then, as you can see there, at 9:05 coming up this morning on OTB AM. Let's get into the back pages. OTB AM. Irish Examiner. Blue Grit is the headline. Chelsea fight back to rescue unlikely point in 8-goal thriller. That's Cesar Azpilicueta celebrating his winner, I think, because he's got his captain's armband in his hand. Before getting chalked off. So well done to the Irish Examiner for leading with my favourite moment of last night, which is Azpilicueta celebrating a goal that never was. Turning to Oba, Gavin Starr, new Arsenal skipper as Xhaka loses role. That's a story we'll get into later with Kenny as well. Striking back, clubs call Mayo's motion of confidence vote into question. Sarri situation, Saracens to appeal heavy-handed punishments, and finishing on a high, Lowry targets race to Dubai glory with one eye on 2020. And you can see Kieran Shannon there as well. Honest self-reflection is required by Irish rugby, but not self-flagellation, which he makes the point that, to sum this up very briefly, that how bad can Irish rugby be if they manage to attract a coach of the calibre of Razzy Erasmus, and look at what he's done. How bad can Irish rugby be if someone like Felix Jones is involved in a World Cup winning squad? Cool the jets for a moment.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's kind of a little bit like Richard Cooper's kind of Owen Sheehan. We've so much to talk about in sports journalism that we just have to talk about something. There has to be something wrong, or there has to be something great. And I've made the point that I think Ireland could well win the Six Nations, because it's kind of like the opposite to England going into the World Cup final, where England were so heavy favourites, which they probably didn't deserve to be. Ireland now, all the pressure is off, and basically, you know, we haven't become a really bad team in this space of the last 12 months. We've issues, but we've very good players, and things will be fine. I think people do probably need to, and also England are more beatable than they looked a week ago. This is in the Irish Daily Mail. Chaos in Mayo, possibly a play on moonlight in Mayo. Although I doubt it. Row breaks out over a vote of confidence. That actually was the first thing I thought of. Moonlight in Mayo, and I saw that. I was like, is that? Probably not. Six Nations now open to New World League. Six Nations have held talks to Southern Hemisphere. Creation of a New World Championship Series. It follows the collapse. Of course, you must be a fan, bringing Japan into possibly into this, I presume.
Get them involved in every facet of life.
Yeah. Would this entail like Japan, Georgia, Russia, that sort of thing? Or would it be just like the good Northern Hemisphere teams?
Just the good Northern Hemisphere teams, from what I can gather. It's not really the World League that was floated last year.
Right.
Maybe more an irregular version of that. So there were some concerns that the likes of the Premiership and all that would lose a bit of power, because you'd have so many international fixtures during the year. Player welfare was what was used as an excuse as to why they shouldn't go through. But
yeah.
Now they're saying that perhaps everybody doesn't play everybody in a calendar year. It's kind of spread out across a number of years,
right,
across a cycle, and that's their new. That's the long and short of it.
The long and the short. I got to give a mention to Philip Quinn's article as well. League of Ireland would benefit from this lucid thinking, and that's obviously an article in relation to the Cup Finals crowd, and also the lucid plans for an All-Ireland League, which look pretty unlikely at the moment after the IFA.
Were you surprised by the IFA response last week?
I wasn't in that.
It seems like we'd forgotten to talk about them when we were speaking about the All-Ireland League.
Yeah, well, the IFA doesn't really run the Irish League.
Sure.
But it does sort of have to, you know, give the all clear for the club. So it's quite different up there in that. It'll probably become like it down here, whereas the IFA has kind of lost its mandate of control. The FAI down here. The IFA, I think in 2013 in IFL, it's kind of more clubs run, and it's been quite successful really in many ways. And interestingly, the PFAI is having its awards night on Saturday night, and the IFA representatives will be there. So I'm sure they'll be coming down thinking, oh God, there'll only be one thing on the menu here. But there are still serious reservations about the depth of the Lucid plan in terms of the money that they talk about. Is it actually there? Is the TV money there?
And how sustainable is that?
And how sustainable it is. But I thought that the IFA jumped a gun a bit, whereas, like, can you not at least let the clubs themselves vote on this and see? Because they kind of just, like, put the, you know, they almost, like, shot it and ruled it out ever happening, because. And I thought a little bit prematurely, you know, there's still discussions to be had. I'm entirely in favour of an All-Ireland League, but I hope the IFA did it for good reasons, football-related reasons. And I'm not saying they didn't, but I certainly hope it wasn't to do with, you know, the preservation of the status quo or whatever, because I think Irish football would be much, much better in an All-Ireland League scenario. Just, we'd be stronger together, basically.
Yeah, using the words of Sia Khaleesi there to further the All-Ireland League.
Wasn't quite as profound as his. What a speech. Unbelievable. Cool-looking dude as well.
Yeah, very much yeah, so. It's yeah.
First black captain of the Springboks, I think.
Yeah.
Which I was amazed at. I only realised that yesterday. So there was a piece yesterday about his club, or where he basically learned how to play and how impoverished it remains. And basically, if they have any kind of facilities, it's to do with him donating money. But still a seriously complex country, South Africa, as we said.
Mm-hmm. That's for sure. Back page of the Irish Independent features a photograph of Bernard Brogan and Ronaldo picturing together for people listening on radio, not Cristiano Ronaldo, the actual Ronaldo. And that was at Web Summit in Lisbon yesterday. So I think Bernard Brogan also posed with Vladimir Klitschko, posted it on his Twitter account. Klitschko's interview with Jura coming up a little bit later on. The main story though on the back of The Independent is twist in Mayo funding row as grassroots revolt grows. Seven clubs are now questioning the authenticity of a vote of confidence in the latest county board meeting. So there was an in-camera county board meeting on Monday night. There was apparently a vote of confidence for the county board, and the veracity of that vote of confidence has been questioned by seven clubs, as I mentioned. Charlestown, Lewisburg, Ballycastle, Ardnamurray Sarsfields, Laugharne Dan McHale's, Barashiel and Castlebar Mitchells are the clubs contesting. It's a very interesting story. A civil war is almost breaking out in Mayo GAA at this point. It seemed to me at the start that it was Mayo GAA versus Tim O'Leary in a sort of give me the money, you give me the plans and I'll give you the money, and there was a bit of a misunderstanding. That may still be the case, but it's now permeated through down to the grassroots level, to the point where clubs are actually like, hold on a minute, do we actually support our county board in this? So it's a mess at this point, and Mayo have found another way of giving us something to talk about during the off-season. There always seems to be something. But then you had this added thing last night where Dermot Butler sent out a communication saying if delegates have or had an issue with last night's meeting, the proper form is to go through their respective club secretaries. The use of social media by clubs to release their statements beggars belief. And the sentiment from last night's meeting was that clubs should not use social media in such a format as a minority of clubs have chosen to do so in this instance. And then the other like thing that kind of goes into line a little bit with this is that they decided at that meeting on Monday night that media would just not be allowed into to any meetings except for their general congress or their big annual, their AGM basically or whatever it is. Media will be allowed into that, but at no other in no other cases will media be allowed into to watch their meetings. Like there is the other thing that kind of stuck out to me just on that very subject is the chairman Mike Kennelly saying that he expressed, this is from Colm Keyes' piece I should mention by the way, still in the Irish Independent, Kennelly is understood to have expressed the view that the county should be better at getting its own message across and should develop their own platforms to do that, overlooking the fact that the county already has sufficient media platforms in place to deliver on that front. It's mad that somebody in the year 2019 would say we should have some sort of method of being able to control our own narrative. You have a website, you have a Twitter account, you have an Instagram account, you have all these sort of things. I don't know what he's actually referring to there. But
well, I remember when I had a League of Ireland website when I was about 16, and it was back in the days, and the League of Ireland was really struggling, it has to be said, and even back then, it was notable that the League of Ireland was miles ahead of the GAA in terms of the internet. And it's still, it reminds me of that story of the GAA is still, it's still quite, there's still probably a lot of old men at the wheel who kind of haven't fully embraced like social media and all that, as for all that it is a cesspit in many ways. It's still, it reminds me of the story of the journalist ringing up one of the county PROs, and he was an old man, and he was telling them, you know, oh, you can get it on the website. And he said, oh, what's the address of that website? And he goes, oh, it's www. And he goes, oh, hang on a second, how many W's? And I still think they're miles behind, like, you know, but yeah, I just find it quite demoralising what's going on in these county boards. They shouldn't be the story. The story should be the players. And in Galway, there's the county finals on Sunday, and there's still no manager into November. And that's entirely county board related. There's no doubt about that. I think people in Galway seem to be reluctant to go for the job. And I see their Pádraig Joyce is quoted from Galway Bay interviews in the papers today, kind of defending the county board as he kind of has to. But anyway. This is the Times London edition. Matthew, I'm not sure if that's Matthew Seed or Matthew Syed.
Matthew Syed, yeah.
Matthew Syed. VAR takes the emotion out of football. It should be binned. Just kind of what we were saying. The Xhaka thing, Xhaka facing January exit. I have a lot of sympathy for Xhaka. He told some fans to, you know, politely F off effectively, but it was a moment of frustration, and he seems to be really vilified for this. He seemed to have to deal with a lot of stuff on social media, even about his family and all that. He's a very, very good footballer, Xhaka. Arsenal are in a pretty bad way at the moment. A lot of pressure on Unai Emery. Two wins out of eight, something like that.
Yeah.
Xhaka, I don't know if he's a fall guy, but I think he's been hard done by.
Emery said he's not in the captain's group anymore. The basic, you can't sit with us.
Captain's group.
So he basically named like four or five players that would be the cohort of leaders that would be the potential captains when Koscielny left. And Xhaka has not only not, no longer is he captain, he's also not allowed to sit with the captains anymore. You know,
well, I think there'd be a lot of, Xhaka probably, he may not be the most likable character in ways on the pitch, but his quality will mean that there'll be a lot of clubs that'll snap him up in a heartbeat.
Yeah. The Irish Times this morning leads with that photo from Stamford Bridge last night. Crazy night sees Chelsea go from zeros to nearly heroes. and Liverpool edge closer to knockout stages. We've got toothless Barcelona, draw blank at home. They drew nil all with Slavia Prague in one of the early games yesterday. And split squads, Liverpool to play two games in less than 24 hours. So they'll play two cup competitions on two continents in less than 24 hours next month. So they've got to play the EFL Cup quarter-final against Aston Villa at Aston Villa as originally scheduled. And then they have to go to the Club World Cup. Which one are you prioritising?
Well, it wouldn't be the Club World Cup, I think, to be fair.
What about the historic international treble that they can achieve in the year 2019?
Yeah, I just wouldn't. I'd be a bit of a traditionalist at the same time.
You're a Carabao man. That's where your traditions lie.
Absolutely. Absolutely. This is the Mirror. No guarantees for Ax Xhaka. An interesting story. It's a little bit into the paper, which is to do with Mario Balotelli. Balotelli in suit threat, and Mario Balotelli could be sued by Verona Council after walking off the pitch in protest at racist abuse. I mean, Balotelli is a clown in many respects, but in this instance, I think he's done a lot of good. I think he's brought the issue to the fore again. And if that were me, if I were a black player, I'd walk off the pitch every time, just like, I'm not dealing with this. You can do whatever you want. I don't know if you want to punish the fans, punish the club, do whatever you want, but I'm not playing under these conditions, and you can basically go screw yourselves. And Balotelli is entirely in the right. But Italy is, I'm actually reading Paddy Agnew's book, Calcio, at the moment. Just, it was like one of these moments where I was at home and I was like, I've loads of books here that I've never read, so I just picked it up and I'm in the early stages. But Italian football, and I've been over there, in terms of its attitude to racism, is really, really weird. Like, it's completely at odds with they don't. It's almost like they don't see it as racism. They just see it as like a way of abusing an opposition player. But it's like it's Neanderthal stuff.
Yeah, it really is. And that really came through in the comments as well in the aftermath of that at the weekend. The back page of the Irish Daily Star is Blue Unlimited. 8 goals, 2 own goals, 2 penalties, 2 red cards, 2 VAR controversies. They are the statistics from Chelsea against Ajax last night. Not keen to comment. Olympic Federation of Ireland President Sarah Keane kicked a touch last night when she asked about her reported interest in becoming the new CEO of the FAI. And Xhaka is demoted, as we've already mentioned. We've already mentioned as well, bizarre twist in Mayo Rao. And Sam Pair, time's up for O'Gara. And McGlynn, that's Frank McGlynn and Owen O'Gara, both hanging up their boots on the inter-county scene yesterday.
The Keane one is interesting, though. I hadn't actually seen that because the FAI, you know, situation is rumbling on, and you know, the next figurehead is going to be so important. Albeit he or she won't have like sort of an autocratic way of running things. It'll be more like a new board and all that with independent members. But it'll be very interesting. A woman ahead of the FAI would be a great departure from where we were at, and it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see who they appoint, because.
But she can't go cleaning up every organisation in Ireland.
Yeah, I mean, her stock seems to be very high, you know, and it would be I don't even know how this is going to happen now and when it'll happen, but the amount of clubs out there who are in limbo waiting on funding and who've been really let down by what's happened is it's quite depressing, really. And this is the Sun, which is for the merrier. It's really the challenge for the writers to come up with a headline for the Chelsea game. Goodbye, McGlynn. Obviously about Frank McGlynn's retirement, and as Saracens, their 35-point deduction again in the headlines there.
Rob Kitson makes the point in the Guardian this morning that you'd have to go back 10 seasons for Saracens to be within 35 points getting relegated, so they should be okay. Saracen should be thrown out of the league is the headline on the Telegraph for that, but their main story is Chelsea thriller. 8 goals, 2 red cards, 2 penalties, 2 own goals, but VAR denies Lampard victory. That is a picture of Reece James celebrating Chelsea's final goal. He is Chelsea's youngest ever goal scorer in the Champions League.
I didn't realise how much the Saracens logo looks like Drogheda United's. It's with Drogheda's has some sort of strange link to, I think, Trabzonspor, some Turkish team. But I don't know where it came from in the Saris anyway. But silencing the critics back at the Racing Post, Spurs can maintain recent upturn in form. Racing Post tipping Spurs to go to Belgrade and win tonight. And the front, Elliot revved up over Applejade. And it makes a point that Elliot had 7 winners at Down Royal last week. Last week is actually only over 2 days. And so the title race is heating up a little bit in Applejade could return. It's actually an unbelievable weekend of racing, particularly the entries in Navan. So Ferry House was called off yesterday, but I think weather-wise should be fine for the rest of the week.
To be honest with you, I'd never even copped the Drogheda United logo. Had the same makeup as the Saracens. Like, the Saracens one is fairly obvious, but I'm not sure, was there actual Muslim influence in the club, or was it just like, let's use that name and let's use that sort of logo? Because
I can't quite recall the draw of the story, but it's very unique in Irish football. It is.
There's a deep dive in that, Johnny, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, let's name the date.
Back page of the Herald this morning, finally, because we're almost out of time, is O'Gara calls time on Dubs. And then lastly, we've got the Irish news. Vernon has high hopes for a full-strength Armagh. And then you've got a picture. Loving how the editors are putting Azpilicueta celebrating an on-goal last night. So
what actually happened? I should ask this. What happened after he put the ball in the net?
There was a handball. Which wasn't a handball.
What sort of handball was it?
Ball to hand. In the good old days, a sort of... Well, there's no chance you would have seen it with the naked eye, really, in the good old days, and there wouldn't have been much of a complaint, I would have thought.
This would have really riled me if I'd actually done proper research this morning, because I find like that the handball ruling is the most stupid thing I've ever seen in football, where if it hits your hand at all at this stage, like it's... if there's no intent and the hand is just in the process of an attacking position, as you said, the good old days, like where it is that situation where it was Man City and Spurs earlier in the season where nobody in the ground knows the handball and then it's given as a, and on that occasion, Mr. Sheehan, I'd actually backed Man City to win the game, so I was running around the pub roaring, and then like a minute later I was reduced to my seat and just going, ugh. That was a fairly grim moment. That was the antithesis of the Azpilicueta goal. So from a betting perspective, from a punting perspective, this stuff is just like it fries your brain, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, I'd imagine it does. Right, just before we move on, just to tell you, there's an online auction taking place this week for the Manus Kelly Trust. The trust was set up after Manus's death at the Donegal International Rally this summer to help support his wife and five children. Up for auction is a test drive with a WRC driver, including flights and accommodation. You can also bid on All-Ireland tickets for next year. There's a Conor McManus and Michael Murphy joint training session or presentation up for grabs as well. There's tons of things to check out and possibly bid on the website. You can go to manuskellytribute.ie and click on the auction tab. So that's manuskellytribute.ie. There's loads of information about the trust up there as well. Click on the auction tab if you want to get involved. Also on the website, there is a link for donations, and any small contribution is greatly appreciated. So it is 1 minute past eight on this Wednesday morning. We've got plenty coming up for you this morning on OTBAM, the sports breakfast show from Off the Ball. Football is up next. We're back after these. OTBAM.
Obviously, Pep was so well in control in everything that he does. It's a fascinating insight. Was it a little slip from him where he finally let his true feelings come out? There's many different ways you could read it and what he meant by it. It might be him trying to start mind games with some description. Another way to look at it is it might be a little kind of nod to referees to say, hey, listen, you know, this guy's a diver in an odd way, because referees will hear that in the press, and maybe just planting a little seed, you know, that next time there's a contentious decision or next time there's a... Because with VAR now, it's difficult to label anyone a diver, so to speak, but I don't know what way to read it. It's so out of character from him. I don't think he might not have meant it. It might just have been like kind of a little wry joke or something like that. There's a million ways to look at it. Either way, it was out of character. You could go even deeper and say that, is he a little bit rattled now? Because that thing you were saying there, where like, you know, Graham was saying there, sorry, about, oh, you know, he's thinking of Liverpool. I mean, God almighty, he of course he's thinking of Liverpool. Yeah. I mean, that's such a, I mean, whether he admit it or not, I'd say Liverpool is the only thing that really worry him or bother him, and he's continuously worried or thinking about him. So I don't really know which way to look at it. It might be much to do about nothing, or maybe it's a sign of first little chink in his armour that the pressure is getting to him, or he's really worried that Liverpool have opened up such a gap now that he's thinking, God, we're going to do ever so well, or Liverpool will have an almighty collapse for us to catch him here, and maybe it's the beginning of the mind game.
Kenny Cunningham, a very good morning to you.
Morning, lads.
So we heard Damien there talking about these comments from Pep Guardiola, suggesting that Sadio Mane is prone to diving a good bit on Saturday. He has since come out to clarify that. He says, it was far from my intention to say that Sadio Mane is that type of player, because I admire him a lot. For Jurgen, it was a penalty. For the referee, it was a penalty. And VAR, it was a penalty. Maybe I was wrong or not to think it was a penalty. Jurgen knows Sadio better than me, and I have incredible respect for that. When Klopp says he's not like this, then it is not like this. So is that the case closed, Kenny?
Yeah, sounds like it. Yeah, loving resumed. Yeah, it was a bit of an odd comment from Guardiola. It took me a bit by surprise. And it wasn't as if he was kind of led down that direction, was it? By the interviewer, obviously wanted to make a point, but I thought it was pretty weak, to be honest with you. You know what I mean? I thought he was a little bit better than that. So I'm glad they've actually brushed it on the carpet, because these things can get very tedious, these comments leading up to such a big game. You want to be concentrating on the football and, you know, the individual qualities of each team's players on the pitch going into the game.
How much do you reckon someone like Pep Guardiola gets obsessed with his opposition in a week like this? How much is he thinking about Klopp and Liverpool?
Well, he gives out the impression, Owen, that it's all about him, his team, their individual qualities, you know, the collective setup of the team, kind of their mentality. How often do we hear that? And I kind of quite believe him. You know, he's very focused on his team's preparation and actually putting the game plan into practice in terms of the football they want to play week in, week out, maintaining that high level of performance regardless of the opposition, regardless of whether it's home or away. That's his kind of philosophy. We hear that kind of drumbeat so often. So I'm always a little bit surprised when he kind of deviates away from it. But I think that, but underneath the owner, there is a little bit of pressure there from Manchester City's point of view. Haven't been in this position too often over the last couple of years. Yes, Liverpool had that big lead halfway Jordan last season, but there's real pressure on Manchester City, even the early stages of this season, the obvious lead which Liverpool have. So clearly a little bit of pressure on the shoulders of Guardiola and his players going into the game against this weekend, as there is the Liverpool players as well. They're going into the game in the knowledge that if they can beat Manchester City, you know, the gap opens up to 9 points. If they don't, you know, it's back to 3 points and it's kind of game on.
Which of the two teams have you been less convinced by so far, Kenny? I know obviously City are six behind, but you know, Liverpool aren't at their best either. Most people would agree, but like, where is your kind of allegiance at the moment in terms of who's going to win this?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, that, John, because I mean, looking at the table, you'd say, well, automatically Liverpool are in the best form, they're the best team, but in a funny way, I'd probably argue the opposite in terms of if you actually look, dissect Liverpool's performances since the start of the season. For me, it's just more so that kind of attitude, that kind of mental resolve, a kind of bit of kind of relentless energy which they have in terms of, you know, focusing on that title, which is kind of giving them that 6-point lead. Yes, they've played well and some great individual talent within the squad has won them games. But in terms of the collective unit, so far this season, I haven't exactly been bowled over by them. I'm still not exactly sure in terms of the balance, just in a couple of areas of the team. John, that central midfield area for me is one which I'll be fascinated which way Klopp jumps before the game at the weekend. Oxlade-Chamberlain pushing hard now for a start for me, and that midfield three, he's been so loyal to Fabinho, kind of Henderson and Ronaldo. He must be seriously thinking maybe just changing the dynamic in that central midfield area, you know, to cope with the threats of De Bruyne and Silva in particular. But yeah, but you are right, I don't think it's been perfect for Liverpool. The defensive unit for me has been a little bit out of sync. Obviously, Klopp's made a couple of changes there at centre-half in terms of Matip and Lovren. Gomez was in last night. I'd love to see him settle on a pair in at centre-half. For me, it's Gomez and Van Dijk. I'm a bit surprised that he's kind of taken Gomez out of foreign line and stuck with Lovren and Matip. But I think there's more to come from Liverpool. You're right. It hasn't been a perfect couple of players, individual performances here and there. You felt a little bit below par as well. So bit of encouragement for Manchester City, actually, I think, going into this game. And if Guardiola focused on his own team and producing their kind of high level of performance, particularly from an attacking point of view, we always know defensively there's little frailties there. Liverpool can pounce on the counter-attack. But in possession of the ball, if they're really at it in terms of a crisp pass and a movement ahead of the ball, that kind of real dynamism which they possess in kind of midfield and forward areas, clearly they can really cause Liverpool problems.
Where are you on that high line, actually, which again looks something that they, you know, they looked a little bit vulnerable from it last night. They've conceded 9 goals from 11 games in the league, which is okay, but what if you were in that defence, you know, would it be something you'd embrace, or would you be kind of thinking, listen, this is just fraught with danger?
Yeah, don't mind the high line, John. I've spoken about this before, but it's all about the decision you make once you hold that high line. It's all dependent on other factors then. Every team I've played in has always looked to push up the pitch and keep as high a line as possible, push the opposition away from your goal, push your midfielders and your forward players higher up the pitch to engage the opposition players. So that's kind of, generally speaking, what most teams are trying to do. But once you get that high line, wherever it is, if that high line is 5 yards from the from the halfway line or halfway inside your half. Once you squeeze as high as you can, it's all about what happens next. And what happens next in terms of where you hold that line or where you begin to drop off and protect the space, it's all about what's happening in front of you in terms of the opposition and pressure on the ball. Has the opposition got the ball? Who has it? Is there enough pressure on the ball? What's the distances? And you've got to compute those things very quickly. In fact, you have to compute them as you're actually on your way up the pitch in terms of squeezing. So by the time you get up there and you hold that line, you actually already know what you're going to do. Are we going to hold that line? Have we forced the opposition player to hit the ball early, blindly in behind, knowing that opposition forwards haven't got back to onside positions? If they have got back into onside positions, the man in possession now has good possession. He's got time. He's got his head up. He can actually wait now to pick the pass in behind us off the shoulders of our centre-half. Then we've got to drop in. We've got to drop 5, 10, 15 yards deeper and protect the space in behind. That's how Liverpool haven't been doing very well this season. I saw early in the season, first couple of games of the season, and they haven't really rectified it, really forcing that kind of high line. And it doesn't matter how quick your centre-halves are at times, if they're stood still, feet planted on the ground, and an opposition play, it may not be the quickest thing in the world, but if his time and if his run is right in behind and the ball is released at the right time as well, then you're going to be caught out. So it's just it's not a huge gaping problem for Liverpool at the moment, but it's certainly something that they need to tidy up on.
That kind of comes back to the cohesion, I guess, Kenny, between your centre-halves and your midfield three. And is that kind of a knock-on reason why finding their best midfield three is something that they need to do quickly? Like, some people would argue that they've already done that, but you're kind of leaning towards Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. I kind of agree with you that as the season wears on, he might find himself as one of the starting midfielders, one of the first-choice three for Liverpool in that position.
Yeah, I think, as you know, I'm a big fan of Oxlade-Chamberlain. I think the season progressively will play a more prominent part. Keita, for me, as well, is an interest, and there's more to come from him. The biggest question for me, though, and I know obviously Liverpool supporters might be shouting and screaming at me, is Fabinho's position in that holding midfield position. I'm not totally convinced. He's a very good player, don't get me wrong. We're not arguing here, is he a good or a bad player? He's a very good player, very talented, very good all-rounded player, very good at possession, distribution's very good. But as a purely defensive midfield player, going into this game there against Manchester City, that holding midfield player then needs a very specific skill set to cope with the problems that kind of Silva and De Bruyne are going to give you in those inside channels. You've really got to be switched on defensive. You've got to sense danger. You've got to slide across the pitch, make tackles, track runners, you know, just sense danger every 5-10 seconds. And for me, that's not the strongest part of Fabinho's game. And if you actually look at some of the significant number of the goals that Liverpool have conceded this season, it's down to kind of Fabinho's kind of just lack of alertness, not kind of sensing danger, and at times not having the leg power, lads, to get across the pitch and snuff out danger. If you think back to the Chelsea, Kante goal against Chelsea, Kante just waltzed by him in centre midfield, just couldn't run, couldn't move his legs. I'm thinking to the Leicester goal at Anfield a couple of weeks ago. Perez, I think it was, just got in behind him, ball played in behind him, got toward, played in Madison for the goal, didn't see the danger. Even the Arsenal game, the Tottenham game, last week, when Tottenham broke early in the game, Fabinho was the man who missed the first tackle in central midfield when they broke and won back possession. It was a lazy tackle, and then his recovery wasn't quick enough. So small things like that matter in games like this, particularly against Manchester City. And for me, first name of the team, she would be Henderson in that holding midfield position. For me, he's the best defender with the best defensive mindset that Liverpool have, and that's going to be needed to give a little bit of protection to that kind of back four that we're talking about, but also to deal with the threat of De Bruyne and Silva and those midfield areas. You can take your pick ahead of that, Wijnaldum, Oxlade-Chamberlain, Keita, Lallana, whoever it is, and those Milner, in those kind of advanced two midfield positions, those two number eights. But that very specific holding midfield position, this weekend more so than most, you don't need a pass for the ball against Manchester City this weekend. You don't need someone with a high level of technical ability, which Fabinho has, very graceful in possession. You need somebody who'll just sit in there in front of that centre-half, sense danger, deal with the runs of De Bruyne and De Silva, make tackles, block passing channels, block passing lanes for the whole of the 90 minutes. For me, Henderson serves that. Does that job better than anybody else in the Liverpool team.
Yeah, it's interesting that you bring this up, Kenny, and we leave Liverpool here after this clip, but Damien Delaney was talking about something relatively similar at our Virgin Media Roadshow in Dundalk on Monday night. Just have a listen to this.
Good way to look at this, when you spoke earlier about teams bringing in young players, it's a young man's game now, you know what I mean? All these guys are 21, 22 years of age, and when these full-backs are pushed in, the midfield players are pushed in, and the ball turns over, and you go full press, if they beat the press with one pass, the centre-back's job then all of a sudden is slow this down. don't commit and quicken up the counter-attack, slow it down. Because if you've got serious legs at full-back and you're 2'8 and you're 6, they're coming. And the statistics are the modern player can cover 10 metres a second, right? So a player flat out in the pro zone stats is 10, 10.1, 10.2 metres a second. So if you can slow a counter-attack down 1 or 2 seconds, that's 20 metres. And your players like Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold, my God, the cavalry will be coming very, very quick. So when they do beat the press, the centre-back's job or a sixth job isn't to go, oh my God, they beat the press, panic, make another bad decision, and now all of a sudden no one's getting back. Slow down, control it, get it wide, so you're buying yourself another couple of seconds because the cavalry will be coming.
I think it's just got really keen to hear these things. I think that's what Van Dijk does. He almost slows down fast things that are happening, he's buying time.
That's what it is, because the cavalry's coming.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. Because now you've described it. I'll use it now, but I'll give you a bit of credit.
Yeah, it's a good piece of analysis there, Kenny. Is it something that you'd agree with, that almost the role of the modern centre forward against counter-attacking teams is just slowing the opposition down, not being the hero and making that brilliant kind of dispossession with a tackle or something like that?
Yeah, but I think that's always been the case, to be honest with you. That's always been good defending as a centre-half. If you find yourself attention a 1v1 situation close to the halfway line, don't overly commit yourself, don't get yourself torn, don't get rolled. Just buy a little bit of time, be patient, wait for the opportunity to win the ball clearly, or if not, as Dana suggested there, buy a bit of time for players to recover. So that's kind of lends it a little bit to what I'm saying in terms of that holding midfield position. Because if I'm a centre-half and I'm a little bit isolated, forget about Virgil van Dijk, he's pretty much there with anybody 1v1. I'm talking about if it's Joel Matip or Lovren over the other side of the pitch, who wouldn't be as confident in terms of dealing maybe with the pace of Raheem Sterling, that inside left position. They're panicking a little bit 1v1. If I was looking inside of my centre midfielder to come across and give me a dig out, I personally wouldn't want to be hanging my hat on Fabinho, making that kind of ground Damon's talking about quickly. I'd be wanting to see Jordan Henderson eating up the ground as he is. He's a racehorse in terms of how he covers the ground, getting across, snapping into the tackle, or getting across quickly and doubling up with me. Very often nowadays, now Damon's talking about the fullbacks getting back. Fullbacks can't get back. They're that high up the pitch. They're all almost level with the centre forwards, kind of 20, 30, 35 yards distance between them and their centre half. Invariably, it's that holding midfielder. It's his responsibility to get across quickly and double up at those centre halves if they're in 1v1 situations. Fullbacks now are by and large too high up the pitch. They actually can't make it back. That brings back to me original point about that holding midfielder, who you want to see charging across the pitch to give you a dig out if you're in a Liverpool jersey. And for me, it's Henderson rather than Fabinho on that holding midfield position.
All right, very interesting. Just one last question then on Liverpool. We were speaking about Mo Salah earlier on.
There's a Liverpool roadshow this morning, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I know. Can you believe it? The team of the nation. Mo Salah's form, Charlie Nicholas was speaking about it, Johnny Ward is speaking about it this morning on AM, that perhaps there are some flags regarding his form at the moment. I'm not sure. Do you go along with that?
Oh, yeah, but it depends where is the comparison on. If you're comparing at that kind of high watermark, which he was at Liverpool a couple of seasons ago, I mean, it was pretty breathtaking. It was phenomenal in terms of the high level of performance, not just high level of performance, but in terms of the numbers which he was putting down in terms of goals and assists. It was absolutely phenomenal. So I don't think there's any real surprise. He wouldn't be human arm off if there wasn't some kind of drop off and those type of numbers which he was producing not too long ago, probably over a year ago. So yeah, I think you're right. Over the last year, maybe his form maybe hasn't quite been at that level. Has been on occasion it spiked up there and maybe fluctuated a little bit, but it wouldn't be overly critical. And the beauty of this Liverpool team, of course, is if you're to take Salah out of that team, you know, it would be a blow. He's a huge player for them, but such as the quality and such as the balance of the team and kind of forward areas of the pitch, Mane has become so prominent. Firmino is so key in that area of the pitch. You know, whoever he chooses to bring in, whether it's Origi or even Oxlade-Chamberlain, Lallana, maybe one of those wide positions, you still feel as if the Liverpool machine is going to function regardless. So, yeah, Mo Salah at top form, absolutely a huge asset, and maybe actually gives Liverpool the edge at the weekend. But I think the Liverpool squad now is good enough. It's so strong. It kind of looks after itself. You know, one or two people drop out, the unit, you know, it still functions efficiently.
the game of the night last night, Kenny, was obviously at Stamford Bridge, Chelsea 4, Ajax 4, an incredible game. Ajax surrendering a big lead, but that tends to happen, I'd imagine, when both of your centre-backs have been sent off for second yellow cards. At the same time, though, it kind of felt like this massive moment at Stamford Bridge last night, even though the winner was chalked off. And there's all these little moments in this season that just suggest that momentum is building nicely behind Frank Lampard, where he can make a real go of this thing, where he isn't going to become the next manager who after 6 or 12 or 18 months just falls by the wayside. He can actually build something special at this club.
Oh, without a doubt, I agree with you totally. Lampard for me is the kind of real deal. I've always been impressed with him. As soon as he came out of football, I started doing a lot of media stuff. I listened to him a lot and he really kind of impressed me. He's got a really good eye for the game, tactically very astute. Like the way he carries himself, I always felt this was a manager players would love playing for. That seemed to be the case at Derby. And now going back into Chelsea, I think that's even more so the case. I think he's going to be a great Chelsea manager. He's going to be there for the medium to long term. I think he's going to be an England manager. I actually think he's one of the very few young English managers who could actually potentially go and manage, got the attributes to go and manage one of the top clubs abroad. I rate him that highly. And you're right, he's got a wonderful squad there available to him. They obviously want to play, they're getting better. And I think it could be one of the big stories of the season, what's happened at Chelsea. And people talk about how far they are away from Liverpool and Manchester City. Do you know what, at the end of the season, I don't think that gap's going to be so big. I think with some key acquisitions next summer, if he's given the money to spend, and I think he will, I think Chelsea can very quickly start closing that gap between themselves and Liverpool and Manchester City, because they have got some of the most outstanding young talent in the country, and they're only going to get better. They've got some very experienced, good pros alongside them. Just need to reinforce some key areas of the pitch, probably left back, maybe centre-half and centre-midfield as well. But if you can get those top quality signings in next summer, Chelsea are going to be in great shape. Chelsea are only heading one way, because such is the talent of that football club, and you can feel that he's pulled the whole their club together, supporters and players. There's a real bond there between the young players and supporters in the stand. It was the right decision to bring Lampard in, and they're going to bear the fruits of that in the years to come.
It's one of the, I suppose, the disguised blessings of the transfer situation as well, Kenny, and that is that it compelled them to look at these young players. And I think in the wider sense, we do need to look at this if a club is kind of almost forced to play young players or blood young players, it's actually great for the English game, because instead of buying in these like foreign imports, which would inevitably be the case, you are bringing in young English players and you're rewarding them. They're going to improve with experience, and I think the fans love that as well. They love to see young talent coming through.
You're right.
You know?
Yeah, you're right. You saw even the fans last night, John, celebrating the young Reece James has come. I was looking at Aspilicueta quite early in the season, thinking it looks if his legs is gone, his best days are behind. They got a problem there. And then I was speaking to somebody at Chelsea not too long after that, somebody kind of in behind the scenes who kind of very good knowledge of the young set up there. And they said, don't worry about him. We've got a lad coming through, Reece James, going to be a world beater. So these almost conveyor belts of players coming through. And I actually think, John, the actual ban, the type of manager Lampard is, he's such confidence in these young players. I think regardless of the ban, if I hadn't have been there in the summer, I still think these lads would have got their opportunity. Because it's not just a case of, well, we haven't got any players, we've got to put these young lads in. These young kids are absolutely exceptional, John. Mm-hmm. I know you've probably seen as much of them as I am, but the likes of Hudson Odoi, in particular, 18 years of age, absolutely phenomenal. Pulisic, they remember, is only 21 years of age. Mason Mount, we know them all, Abrahams, they are. Reece James as well. One or two others people may not even know already. Some outstanding talent there. They're only going to get better, even by not actually adding to that squad next summer, John. That Chelsea team is going to be better and stronger by the time the season kicks off next year. And you're right, he's actually putting money in the bank, because these players, in terms of their value, is only going to increase over the course of this season. So Frank Lampard has actually put money in the bank at the Chelsea owners, which they like. The team is getting stronger. He's pulling the whole club together. And like I said, for me, over the next couple of years, not even the next kind of 2, 3, 4 years, I'm talking the next maybe 18 months to 2 years, for me, Chelsea are capable of getting onto the coattails of Liverpool and Manchester City.
Last thing then, Kenny, if you're the captain of a top six football club and your own fans are booing you, do you take off your shirt, slam it on the ground, say F off to the fans, and then be happy enough to get the captaincy stripped? Or how do you behave in that manner?
Depends, because if I've been in the gym all week.
Yeah, body. And have you?
I was happy ripping my top off.
Your gym days are over,
no,
Kenny,
probably,
are they?
No, me, Owen, I'd probably run it down, but go to take me top off, it'd actually get stuck around me neck, it'd get all twisted up. And I literally wouldn't be able to get the jersey off, and probably knock into somebody coming off the pitch. It'd be absolutely comical. But No, he probably acted in the wrong way, to be honest with you, Xhaka. But I'll be honest with you, Owen, I think Emery was the problem. He should never allow the players to make the appointment, Xhaka. I think he should have taken responsibility himself. He should have sensed the problems down the road with Xhaka becoming captain, knowing how Xhaka was perceived by the Arsenal supporters. Eventually, he's made a decision which he should have made in the first time around by giving the captaincy to Aubameyang, somebody who's playing well, who's going to be in the team, kind of leads the team in terms of example on the pitch, got a good relationship with the supporters. It's the decision he should have made at the start. He just made it too late.
Yeah, like it's a situation now where there was a leadership group which was appointed after Koscielny left. He was part of that group, Xhaka, and voted to be leader, and now he's not in that group whatsoever now, to the point where they're probably going to sell him in January. Like, once you've gone down this path, that's probably the correct course of action. Is it a situation where Emery's finally realised what the right thing to do is here, or can Xhaka feel properly aggrieved?
I'd be hurting a little bit if I was Xhaka, but I think he's actually taking the pressure off Xhaka a little bit. On, I don't think the right decision would have been, no, I'm going to stick with you. Some people saying, oh, he's got to stick with him, he's got to back him. But he'd been putting a huge amount of pressure on Xhaka's shoulder, sending him back out onto the pitch with the armband on, knowing how he's perceived by the Arsenal supporters, knowing the reaction he's going to get from the Arsenal supporters. That's not good. You don't want to be kind of creating that kind of toxic atmosphere inside the stadium. Arsenal, where they are at the moment, they're playing catch-up. They need what's happening at Chelsea at the moment. They need everybody rallying behind the flag, players, supporters, managers, everybody in it together, looking, pushing each other forward. That hasn't happened the last couple of weeks. It's been a bit fractious at Arsenal, so he's got to pull that whole thing, the whole thing together. And the only way he was going to do that was really by asking Xhaka to step aside. If I was Xhaka, I think deep down he knows himself it's the right decision. It's going to be hard to pick himself up from this, I'll give you that. I don't think it's the end of him at Arsenal. I think if he shows a good attitude, shows the right kind of mentality, I think he can still maybe warm his way back into the affections of the Arsenal supporters if he shows the right kind of attitude. But looking at his body language, his demeanour, how he's been talking, it looks as if his time's coming to an end sooner rather than later.
Yeah, like obviously the abuse he got was completely out of line. And is that just something that a modern footballer kind of has to deal with and not allow that?
What kind of abuse are you talking about, Alan? Like the booing coming off the pitch?
No. The online abuse. You got nonsense.
But that's par for the course. That's the world we're living in. Footballers, celebrity, whoever you are, TV, probably get a bit of yourselves, lads. Dear Johnny, quite outspoken yourself. You probably get a few down the on social media, I'd imagine. You're going to have a tough skin. Like, that's got to bounce off you. Like, you put yourself out there, you go on social media, put things out, you're going to get it back. There's idiots out there. There always will be. War's never going to change like that.
Yeah, like,
that's
there was...
That's par for the course. Unfortunately, you have to go on with it. You have to kind of harden yourself
It is kind of... That's, unfortunately, that's it. Like, but it does make social media a cesspit. Like, you know, I go on social media on Sunday defending Alan Manus for his stance in the anthem, and, like, I'm called a West Brit, and there are like 50 people liking that. Like, that, I couldn't be less West Brit than anyone. And you're just like, is this actually happening? Like, and it's just, but then when you've what Xhaka had to deal with, where like wishing cancer on his daughter or something like that, you're like, I think we need to get to the point of, you know, also looking into social media and saying, well, like, is everything fair game now? Can you just say anything? Because it's a complete cesspit, like, and generally, it's a cesspit, Kenny, but not everyone can deal with it that way either, you know.
It's a cesspit, that's what it is. It's a cesspit. So, everybody's buying into it, seemingly. Obviously, I don't be involved in it myself. I'm just from the outside looking in. But that seems what it is. It's a cesspit. It's unregulated. Probably always will be from what I can see. So if you involve yourself in that and you're part of it, you got to suck it up. This is it. Mm. Don't let 20, 30, 50 idiots. I mean, you know, there's many billion people in the world. Don't get too hung up about, or 30, 40, 50 people, you know, big men, you know, putting posts up there or whatever. We would never back it up. He went and knocked on the door, they'd probably cringe, like, and fold, like, if you put it on them. So just, you've got to harden yourself up, from what I can see. It is. It's part of the modern world. Just get on with it. Don't get too wound up about it. You just got to live. You just got to go and live regardless.
Yeah, I think if I'd like one word of advice for anyone at the moment, it would be spend less time on your phone and spend less time on social media, and you'll actually be better for it.
And a very good morning to all our viewers watching us on their mobile phones this morning. Kenny Cunningham, thanks a million.
No problem, lads. Take care.
Kenny, you know Kenny wouldn't be on social media. He's just too sensible for that stuff.
What would be his first tweet?
Probably his first tweet. Something to do with this particular moment in time, maybe?
That's the way he calls you, John. Are you going to start calling him Ken?
Yeah. Yeah, maybe. That was the big thing about Brian Clough. He'd always call you by your, like, he'd be Kenneth. Mm-hmm. And he'd a Scottish striker that he turned into a centre back, and I forget his name, but it was Kenny, and he called him Kenneth, and he said, like, I don't even think my mum calls me Kenneth. But no, Kenny's I do wonder, in time, will there be a complete revolt against social media, because there's just so much. Your life really isn't Kenny Byrne. Kenny Burns was it, or Burns? Yeah, Kenny Burns, a Scottish centre forward. I think he turned into centre back. But how much your life's enriched by social media is, I've made this point before, we're not going to be on our deathbed saying, God, I have such fond memories of those days I spent on social media. It'll be like such fond days of the day I fell in love, or the holidays I had, or the people I met. But you won't be talking about social media.
And then in third place is the 5,000 like tweet that you put up once upon a time.
That was great. Let me tell you about that, I tell you.
There is an online auction taking place this week for the Manus Kelly Trust. The trust was set up after Manus's death at the Donegal International Rally during the summer to help support his wife and five children. Up for auction is a test drive with a World Rally Championship driver, including flights and accommodation. You can also bid for All-Ireland tickets for next year's final. And there's a Conor McManus and Michael Murphy joint training session or presentation up for grabs as well. Tons more besides, and you can go on to manuskellytribute.ie and click on the auction tab for more details. That is manuskellytribute.ie. Also on the website, there's a link for donations, and any small contribution, of course, is greatly appreciated. It is 31 minutes past 8 on this Wednesday morning. You're watching OTBAM, and Formula One driver Derek Daly spoke to Joe last night about the comparisons between Michael Schumacher and Lewis Hamilton.
I think Michael Schumacher might be the most complete racing driver I ever saw. What I mean by that is, as regards engineering a team of people around him to be able to give them the feedback, to have the designers to be able to design and build the best, fastest car on a regular basis, to be the fittest racing driver you could possibly be, to commit yourself for all those years, he was the most complete. I'd say Lewis Hamilton is more gifted, a more naturally gifted driver, loose feel, can do anything with a car, and has learned to work hard like Schumacher did. But he's a different style of driver, I think. But Schumacher's complete, but Hamilton might be better overall.
And is he up against the same caliber of drivers that Schumacher was?
Well, if you think back, Schumacher, I mean, he came in at the Senna era. Unfortunately, Senna didn't last long enough. I'm thinking of Sebastian Vettel. I mean, Vettel is pretty good. Vettel is good. I mean, Vettel is extremely good in the right environment. I mean, there's no doubt Hamilton can be beaten. Nico Rosberg proved that. And I think Nico Rosberg retired because of the mental strain of operating at that level. He just didn't want to do it. Hamilton does want to do it on an ongoing basis, but he's different. He's flamboyant. He's not as complete as Schumacher, but he might be as good, if not better.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
The Sunday paper review on Off the Ball.
When he wants to do something, he does it. A hugely impressive person, apart from being obviously a brilliant golfer.
My cousins disliked their dog so intensely that they renamed it Scalacci.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the dog was called Scalacci from then on.
It's a great piece of journalism, but that sums up what he's like. The intro to this is just brilliant. He is an absolute control freak.
Digesting the best stories on the back pages every Sunday afternoon on Off the Ball.
OTB AM.
8:34 on this Wednesday morning. Tom Malone, a very good morning to you.
How are you, Neil?
I'm well, very well. How are you keeping?
Yeah, not too bad. Looking back at Champions League, we'll start with that.
We start with the Champions League.
Both of you have now like fitted neatly into this morning life, like where you work early shifts and you're back. You're now an early riser every day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Is it a good thing?
Yeah,
gives
well,
structure to your day
gives my life structure, John, which you know,
badly needed.
Which is badly needed. Yeah.
How do you find like inserting an early morning into your week?
It's hard enough if you're not that used to it, because you don't tend to sleep very well. Whereas again, last night I kept waking up thinking I've overstepped my alarm, or you know, basically, what time is it?
Constantly pressing.
So I got up in the middle of the night to turn off my flight mode and turn on my phone, such that if I did sleep it in, the taxi driver would be ringing me outside. I actually think it's, if you get up early in the morning, it gives you great structure to your day.
It'd be great if humans just didn't have to sleep. If sleep was just not a thing and energy was just infinite.
I love sleep. There can't be the good sleep. Particularly when you're on the couch in the middle of the day and you've had a tough day but rewarding day and you're free for the evening. The football is going to come on in due course and you just have a little
just
20 minutes to
refresh before it.
Yeah. Lovely, yeah.
It sounds like a great life you have.
But it rarely happens, but it's wonderful when it does, yeah. I do have a great life for that.
Yeah. Let's move on to Champions League. And a pair of red cards for Ajax led to incredible drama at Stamford Bridge overnight. The Dutch side were 4-1 up away to Chelsea in Group H before the hosts battled back to level the game at 4-4. Chelsea thought they'd won the game but had a fifth goal ruled out by VAR for handball. Pensioners manager Frank Lampard was very happy with the performance.
There were moments where Christian and Willian and our pressing off the ball meant that we were firmly in the game and we just needed a bit more. We needed a bit more in the final third and we needed to lift the spirit of the stadium. So I'm delighted with that part of it. And we're probably a bit disappointed in the last 10 minutes not to win it.
In the other game in Group H, Valencia beat Lille by 4-1. While Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain scored the winner for Liverpool as they edged past Genk by 2-1 the Champions League. It was the midfielder's fourth goal in as many games, as many as he'd managed in the previous 45 appearances for the club. Reds boss Jurgen Klopp says it's a case of finishing the job now.
Job done is the headline for the game, pretty much. And most important thing, of course. But group is not decided. We knew from the beginning it's a tough group. And now we are first in the table, but we only want to be first, or really want to be first after last match day.
Also in Group E, Napoli there drew 1-1 at Red Bull Salzburg. And of course, after all those upsets around Europe last weekend, Barcelona failed to bounce back and they can only draw 0-0 with Slavia Prague in the Camp Nou last night.
Saw a bit of that game as well. Like, they're so far behind at the moment.
Apparently Slavia Prague were quite good.
They had a goal disallowed in the first half and the reliance on Messi just seems to be ridiculous at the moment.
That's, Messi should have scored. He backed enough to crossbar. They also had a goal disallowed.
Yeah, there is a kind of a lack for a really outstanding team in Europe at the moment, but I hadn't seen
Barcelona. Barcelona will be fine.
Yeah, that's not...
They're top of the Liga. They're top of their Champions League group.
Yeah.
What more can you ask
for? Whoa. They didn't win two games in a row.
Yeah. There's no crisis.
Yeah. I wouldn't say a crisis, but like they're not the
one
team...
One or two red flags.
Yeah.
Tottenham boss Mauricio Pochettino says Heung-min Son is mentally fit to play in tonight's Champions League game away to Red Star Belgrade. The Korean forward had his red card he received on Sunday against Everton overturned, of course the one that led to that horrific injury to Andre Gomez. And Manchester City can secure their place in the last 16 later with two games to spare. Pep Guardiola's side are at the San Siro to play Atalanta. Arsenal are in Europa League action this afternoon. Their match away to Vitória has been brought forward because the Portuguese side's neighbours Braga are at home tomorrow in the same competition. Of course, Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang has been installed as Arsenal captain ahead of that game. Arsenal boss Unai Emery says Granit Xhaka has been stripped of the captaincy. Of course, he hasn't been featured since that angry exchange with his own supporters during the Premier League game against Palace last month. And Emery says he had to act when it comes to Xhaka, who could now leave in the January transfer window.
I decided he's not one of the captain in our group. And I decided that, and I told him he accepted my decision, and also I told the captain, another captain, that decision.
And in some sad news, actually, two-time Olympic boxing champion Nicola Adams has had to retire from boxing over fears she could lose her sight. The 37-year-old became the first female Olympic champion when she won gold at London 2012, retaining her flyweight title then at Rio 2016. She turned professional in 2017 and became the WBO World Flyweight Champion, but she made an announcement through the Yorkshire Evening Post where she added, "I'm immensely honoured to have represented our country to win double Olympic gold medals and then a WBO championship belt. A dream come true, but it's not without taking its toll on my body." Potentially losing your sight's a pretty big toll to take, you'd think, there. But that's incredibly sad news about...
I had a friend who lost his sight in one eye playing, I think he was playing AstroTurf, actually. And he continued to play on, but he always had, like, sort of glasses, protective glasses on. But, it's one thing losing the sight in one eye, but the danger of losing it in the other, to what that would do to you. So... Yeah, quite serious.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Quick wrap on Gaelic Games. Martin Comerford has joined the Kilkenny Senior Hurling backroom team as a selector under Brian Cody for 2020. Of course, DJ Carey and James McGarry already in there as assistants. And in the, as the spate of retirements continues, Owen O'Gara has become the latest member of Dublin's five-in-a-row squad to announce his inter-county retirement. During 11 years as part of the Dublin panel, the Temple Oak Sing Street clubman won 7 All-Irelands and 5 National Leagues. And rather confusingly for me and you, Johnny, there's racing today from Dundalk, even though it's a Wednesday and not a Friday.
Yeah, Wednesday afternoon fair from Dundalk.
Yeah.
There must be that feeling like this time of year where if when you are an inter-county footballer or hurler, it's like, I just can't go through this winter again.
I was just about to say, it's conclusive proof that November is the worst month.
It's terrible.
Of the year.
I was so blue last Monday. I was just like, oh God. And it was so dark at like 4 o'clock. Horrible weather. It's like, this is grim.
Like Frank McGlynn has had since the middle of the start of August, middle of July, think about this. And he's like, yeah, definitely going back next year. November.
No. Ah. November.
Monday, because Monday was one of the worst days weather-wise year. Yeah. And I was like, no, I can't be having this.
Just want to pack it in, pack everything in at that point.
Yeah.
Thanks a million for that, Tom.
No, cheers.
It is 8:41 on this Wednesday morning. You're watching OTBAM. We are back with Phil the Power Egan talking football and hearing from Vladimir Klitschko with Gerard Gilroy. First, though, let's get back to Niall Quinn and Graeme Souness in the Virgin Media Studio Sports last night. Virgin Sports Studios, I should say, discussing Liverpool versus Manchester City this weekend.
It doesn't decide anything. You know, if Liverpool were to turn City over, they put a marker down that we're, you know, right now we're better than you, and you're now going to have to really, really, you can't afford to slip up. We'll take some catching. If Liverpool come unstuck, the momentum is then with City, and they're believing they're the best team, and Liverpool would have to pick themselves up. It is November, the start of November. Nothing is decided. When we do this job, people are looking for us to come up with clever and things I've not heard before. But really, the only way you can approach this 90 minutes are everything. And then when you come out of that, see where you are after that, and it's the next one after that. Mm. If you're going to win a league, it's the teams who handle the difficult parts of the season. Now, right now, you'd have to say that City have done really well with their injuries to still be where they are, you know, picking up the points, playing the football they're playing. Now, who's to say that maybe Liverpool won't have a period where they get Van Dijk out and maybe they get Mo Salah out for a period of time? Then that's when their test comes. If you win a league, it says more about you. Liverpool, when I was a player there, everything was about winning the league. The cups were just a complete bonus. Even the European Cup was a bonus because that said more about you as a team and more about you as an individual.
But City right now, I think the Champions League is the one that's missing. You know, they've retained their title, and I think that's a big, big step in the Premier League. That was a big plus for them. But I just wonder, is it going to be a year where he concentrates a little bit more? I don't think he can do that.
And we had Niall Quinn there as well in studio last night for Virgin Media Sport. Virgin Media Sport has over 400 UEFA Champions League, Europa League and Nations League games live this season and is available to all Virgin Media TV customers. You can also download the TV Anywhere app. Check out the hashtag WeFreeSport for more. That is not time for a football show, that's what it says on it. Time for Phil Egan to come into studio.
Have you got to offer this for?
Well, I was just about to say,
what are you here for? We've already talked football.
You've talked football, right? You talked football, and there I was at the start of the show listening to John, I think it's more of it.
Are you here to finally do the impressions?
Well, I was about to say, you came in doing a Graham Souness impression there, and it was perfect.
He's great. He's so many. But he just bottles it there.
It was one word. What was the word?
It's just the way he says, Liverpool.
Hey, yeah. He's done it.
He's done it.
At long last.
It's like nailed on.
Yeah. But yeah, so we're going to call you John from now on. I like when Kenny does that.
It extends this kind of intellectual.
More.
Yeah. It's on the birth cert, of course. What are you on, the Philip or Phil?
Philip.
Yeah.
One L.
Yeah. The perfect Philip for our morning action. Yeah. Owen, you're EOIN?
I am.
Yeah.
Owen Francis.
Owen Francis.
I saw an Owen Sheehan on TV there last week, the chef. There's a chef called Owen Sheehan.
No, he's a different. Oh, he's not Owen,
no,
is he?
He is an Owen Sheehan, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Is that changed my name immediately.
Different, not Sheehan though. Sheehan.
Okay, well then, we're very.
But I just thought, names. I thought there's a. In my head, I was like, there's an idea, the two Owen Sheehans in studio at the same time.
We did have the debate before we came in. We're going against the VAR. We're finding it just. Killing our buzz.
Do you know what? I was all for it after the World Cup, and now I find myself when a goal goes in, there's no emotion there anymore. There's not. Because
there's an emotion of anticipation. It's like you know, when in the good old days last season, when a ball used to be say when the ball used to be crossed for somebody and you're like, finish it off, goal.
That
moment of anticipation before they finish the opportunity off. After you score a goal, that now becomes the anticipation. You're like, oh, will he finish it off with VAR?
No.
No, it doesn't really.
It's a week's game at Anfield, Liverpool Arsenal.
It's
no
a
VAR.
Bit like,
it's beautiful.
It's a little bit like being in a nightclub. You know, you've chat up a girl and she's like, you know, yes, this is going to happen or whatever. She goes for a coat and you're like, I'm not sure she's coming back, actually. You just can't celebrate. You just can't be happy anymore. You're not going with that analogy, you know?
No, it
kills the buzz, though.
Yeah.
There's no reason. She hasn't even kissed you yet and you're like, nah. This may not be happening, even though the ball's over the line. May not be a goal.
No, but like, you got to work, Johnny. You got to work, you know?
You got to work. We're against VAR anyway.
Yeah, I just think that thrills of sport and football in particular is when a goal goes in. That's what excites you. And I think back to even a couple of weeks ago when Adam Lallana equalised against United. Part of me was thinking, I think they're going to... That looked tight.
Mm.
That could be given for offside. Now, it wasn't. But it kind of looked at it and just thought.
Do you think the crowd celebration is going to get more muted now?
Think about all the people that basically waste things, like the goal celebration that the player does, the commentator gives it the big one, then has to basically say, well, that was a complete waste of time.
That was a millimetre offside. So.
Just when I was watching the Barca game last night, but as that was going on, Leipzig and Zenit was on one of the other TVs, and I saw Leipzig had gone a goal up. And then I looked again, I was like, oh, it was disallowed. And I looked back at it and it was the most minimal of handballs from a different player earlier in the move. And then it leads to the goal and they chalked it off. And so,
well, the handball is a complete...
Yeah, well, that's a rule change.
Yeah, that's so that, wrong.
I mean, that's not VAR's problem, that's a rule change. But yeah, I'm kind of just sick of it now at this stage. I just want...
Yeah, so am I. Yeah.
We should have a poll. Are you just fed up of VAR?
Fed up of everything to do with VAR, to be honest with you. We have had a lot of feedback from earlier on in the show.
Yeah.
From
throwing shade at Mo Salah.
Well, let's go through some of the comments online. Noel Cahill has been in touch to say, Liverpool are good, but just not clinical in games. Watch the bloody games, Johnny. Conor Joy says, is this the same Liverpool that are unbeaten that Johnny is talking about? Using Charlie Nicholas to back up your argument isn't a good start.
No, that
played at walking pace last night are just getting the game over with. All about Sunday. Just two more here. Declan Kelly, can't agree, lads. If they don't perform at the weekend, then it's a discussion. This is regarding Mo Salah. But thus far, they're doing what's needed. Salah looked sharper last night, so he's playing into form. And John Donoghue says, first half in Old Trafford didn't look like title-winning form.
No, but from Liverpool?
These are all in relation to... Mo Salah, and I presume the general thrust of it is...
Look, you can go through a spate of games here. Liverpool were lucky to beat Chelsea away, which at the moment doesn't look that bad a result. Didn't play particularly well against Manchester United. Didn't play well against Sheffield United. Didn't play well against Leicester. Were lucky to win that game. Didn't really play well against Villa. Were 1-0 down with whatever, 5 minutes left. Conceded 3 goals at home to a fairly average team in the Champions League. Looked ropey enough defensively last night. Lost to Napoli, which was one of their proper tests this season.
They actually played well in that game.
Against Napoli?
Yeah.
They played okay.
They should have won that game.
In Naples?
Yeah.
I wouldn't say they should have won that game.
They had chances, yeah.
Yeah, I don't remember them having enough chance to say they were...
They actually had chances. Mane and Salah actually weren't clinical enough.
Yeah,
that
was one night where they really looked off.
Yeah.
But the Salah debate for me is Liverpool fans will go on the defensive now, and that is a classic defensive of somebody who hasn't won anything for a long time and wants to believe that it's going to happen.
But Liverpool are not actually... They won the Champions League in June.
Hmm?
They won the Champions League.
The league is what matters at this stage. But so the Liverpool fans will go on the defensive. Oh, look at them! How many games have they won? You know, and their record's great. But if you can say that Liverpool are playing really well this season, you don't know anything about football because they're not.
But they did the same last season. They start off like this and they'll hit their form. In terms of Salah, I would never take him out of the team because it just disrupts the whole balance of the team as well. Who are Liverpool's two most creative players? The two fullbacks. So the beauty of having Mane on the left-hand side and Salah on the right means their natural instinct is to cut inside. That's what defenders are going to think as well. What does that do? That creates space for the two fullbacks to get into, the likes of Robertson and Trent Alexander-Arnold. The Old Trafford game, Salah didn't play. Unfortunately, what happened then was Mane was shifted out to the right, so Origi could play on the left. Mane isn't as effective on the right. So Salah, and Kenny alluded to this as well, like that first season, that was...
It was off the charts.
It was a freak season. Mm. He still finished joint top scorer in the league last season, him, Mane and Aubameyang. So also as well, when you have him in the team, he mightn't be in that kind of form that he was in when he scored 44 goals that season. But if you're an opposition defender, you're hardly thinking, yeah, Salah's not as good as he used to be, I'll just leave him free. He occupies defenders as well. Now, one thing I'd be a little bit critical of him in the last few games is taking too much out of the ball. Just, he wants to score so much, and Klopp left him on last night.
For him to score.
Probably thinking he could score. And in terms of the performance last night, I was looking at it and I was just thinking, if Genk make it 2-2, Liverpool will go and score a third goal. They were played so within themselves. It's all about Sunday. I think I felt like this going into the Spurs game that Liverpool were going to absolutely tear into Spurs. I remember I was sitting down in the pub to watch it, and I was there before the game. I was like, lads,
happy days.
Watch this now. Liverpool are going to tear Spurs apart.
And a 1-0 down.
47 seconds in, I was like, Jesus Christ, what has happened? So I'm expecting a bit of the same actually on Sunday. I think Liverpool are primed for this game.
Oxlade-Chamberlain is very much an interesting one because he has, like, his goal scoring this season gives them an option for midfield that they just don't have. They're so reliant on those three players scoring goals up top.
I completely agree. I think
I know you're a big fan of the Ox, and he obviously has
the Chamberlain. Does the Ox, like, could the Ox fit into a different position? If, like, are they going to are they always going to play the three up top? In which case, could the Ox play up top as well? Because he could, because defensive midfield is not his game. So, what does he offer as a midfielder? Mainly goals, and like amazing goals this season. Absolutely. He looks like he's going to score every time he's at the edge of the box.
Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain would be brilliant in the Manchester City system. Granted, it's not drastically different to how Liverpool play, but in midfield it is, with their advanced number eights, the Kevin De Bruyne's, your David Silva's. I'd love to see Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain in those sort of positions, whereas Liverpool's midfielders, it seems to me,
feed
are often a bit more reserved, and it's just,
feed
over
the ball
the top.
To top three.
The way you could play him on Sunday, and he's a great record against City, he scored that Champions League goal, he scored in the 4-3 as well at Anfield. So you can play Fabinho and Jordan Henderson, because Jordan Henderson will cover the ground for you, and then Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain can play in, so almost on the left-hand side, so you've Fabinho sitting in front of the front or the back four, then Henderson slightly out to the right, and then Oxlade-Chamberlain to the left. Now, they don't have to stick to those positions, but because he's dynamic as well, he can get around the pitch, and if he gets to within 25 yards out and he has a side on goal, we know he can absolutely hammer one in, and as I said, he's done it a couple of times against Manchester City. So there's certainly a call for him to start on Sunday, and
probably
Klopp talked about him after the Villa game. He said Oxlade-Chamberlain made a huge difference when he came on. He talked about him last night as well, and
trying to get between the lines,
and that's why I think there's a very good chance he will start.
His goal in Genk probably didn't get the love it deserved as well. The technique to do that, like, it's just like outside the foot, literally inch perfect.
The goal last night was quality as well. The way he just turned and.
In a flash, like, at a time when they kind of needed a goal as well.
Jimmy McCullough's been in touch to say, nailing VAR with his nightclub scenario. Brilliant morning conversation. We've all been there. So it's not just hate coming for you this morning, Johnny. Your VAR comparisons are getting a lot of love.
No, but it is a good wider debate, though. Like, is it kind of taking the joy out of a goal? And, like, you should, like, a goal is an amazing thing. And when you score a goal and you're a striker and you look up to see that the linesman hasn't, like, that feeling of relief, to have to wait kind of 20 seconds and kind of hover around and say, maybe not. Is VAR doing more damage than good at the moment in terms of the enjoyment of the game? And that's probably a big question. I'm with Phil on this, I think. Yeah, we need a campaign. We need to campaign on this, Phil.
I was trying to work out over the weekend, because this is the first season it's in the Premier League. It's obviously been in Germany, it's been in Spain, it's been in Italy. And I was trying to figure out, is it just the fact that the Premier League officials are so bad? Is this why VAR isn't been that successful in the Premier League so far? I don't watch as many games in those other leagues that I mentioned. I watch games in those leagues, but not to the same extent that would the Premier League. So I'm trying to work out, do they have the same problems, or is this more with the Premier League officials are so bad?
How far away are we from an instantaneous decision? Like, put it to you this way, if you're playing a game of FIFA, you're never going to get an incorrect offside call. So, like,
in a
video game, there is an ability to say that that person is at that level, that person's in that level. Like, I'm not saying that that's incredible whatsoever. It's completely different. But I don't know. It, surely there is a point that this technology gets to where it isn't instantaneous, where it's like tick. It features all the different things that we have built in to our algorithm here. That is a perfect goal. And then there is, like, I don't know, big green tick up on the big screen. The player doesn't need to look at the forward official anymore, or at the side of the linesman anymore. They're looking up at the screen and they're like, perfect goal.
That's a dystopian future, you know. It's a future for me, Johnny. I did watch one bookmaker did like a piece with Shamrock Rovers players playing FIFA against each other before the cup final. And
who was the best player?
It was Jack Byrne, Graham Burke, Aaron McAniff, and Aaron Green. But oh my God, like, it looks so good. Like, I haven't played computer games in years. Like, it was off the charts, like, the passes you could do and all this.
Yeah. If I got any of those consoles, good luck. Like, I'd have
same. You'd be done.
I had to get rid of Championship Manager years ago because. I was staying up till 3 in the morning. I was so engrossed, and I wasn't far off putting on a suit for the cup final.
I had mates who used to do that. Yeah. For the cup final, they'd dress up and like take photos of themselves and all. I still remember playing my brother's the Sega the Mega Drive like for 6 or 7 hours in end. Next thing, my mother comes into our room and trips over the Sega and the whole thing is plugged out. Yeah. He's like, no. There are the simpler days, when you know.
But this one is pacing up and down beside a laptop, shouting, "Press up!" Then go to the laptop, "Press up!" That's it. It is 8:56. Phil, you need to leave us to go back and do the day job.
Give us your Liverpool again.
What?
Your Suey.
Liverpool.
It's just one word. I think it's whetted his appetite for more, though.
Jer has gone to Lisbon. He's been catching up with Vladimir Klitschko over at the Web Summit. Here's what the former heavyweight world champion said on what he learned from losing to Anthony Joshua.
Can I ask you about the Joshua fight and your reaction to that? Because I think in the eyes of the world, everybody knew you were a great champion, but that was the night where yourself and Joshua in the 5th and 6th round produced one of the greatest spectacles that we've seen in the ring since the 60s and 70s. It was an all-time great fight. For you, in the context of learning from failure, I don't know if you view that as a failure, though, because it was such a fantastic evening and as a boxing historian, you've got a place in history now that no one's ever going to take away. So I just wanted to ask you how you feel about that fight now in retrospect.
There is a lot in that fight. That fight actually made me think differently. I was obsessed about to become a champion again. Being a champion was 12 years. The longest combined reigning champion in history. Just something to talk about it. Well, that's the fact. And I what I want to say with that, I have experienced a lot of success, but I never ever have experienced success when you fail. So I failed, and my slogan of the team was, failure is not an option for a long time. But after this fight, I decided to change. Failure with obsession is an option, because out of it came much, much more. Just to experience that, I probably wouldn't change the end of the fight. My ego would, but I wouldn't just experience that. And I know, I'm facing those people who have experimented with artificial glass, those scientists that eventually created Post-it or super glue, and it was a failure. They haven't succeeded in the first. Christopher Columbus was on his way to India, and he failed. So
yeah, Vladimir Klitschko speaking to Jerry Gilroy at Web Summit yesterday, and you can read more on that interview at offtheball.com later on today. Just to tell you that there is an online auction taking place this week for the Manus Kelly Trust. The trust was set up after Manus's death at the Donegal International Rally during the summer to help support his wife and 5 children. Up for the auction is a test drive with a WRC driver, including flights and accommodation. You can bid on 2020 All-Ireland final tickets. There's a Conor McManus and Michael Murphy joint training session or presentation and much, much more. And you can go to manuskellytribute.ie and click on the auction tab for more details. Also on the website, there is a link for donations and any small contribution is greatly appreciated. So it's manuskellytribute.ie. Right, it is 8:59 on this Wednesday morning. We've got a Paddy Houlihan interview coming your way next on OTB AM.
OTB AM. This
is OTB Sports Radio.
Hooligan by Paddy Hooligan is by Paddy Hooligan is out now. It's brilliant, Paddy. You're very welcome to the studio.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Pleasure to be here again.
Hooligan, obviously based on your nickname, the Hooligan. It's something that you refer to as an alter ego throughout the book. Can you explain that to us? Who is the Hooligan?
I think we all have it. I think we all have that little voice, and sometimes he's telling you that you can't do it, and sometimes he's telling you, fortunately for me, that you can. You know, so it's like when I hit rock bottom, it's like there's a spring installed. You know, so when I hit that rock bottom, that moment where I'm on my own and I'm like kind of in a situation where it's getting sticky.
So it only comes out really in a low point.
Sometimes it hasn't. There's been times where I've went to fights and at the door, I know in the dressing room when it's there, you know, it's like it comes in and it's like, yes, I can feel it. And I think most fighters, when I start talking about it even more, I think most fighters will start going, you know, wow, we have that too. And it is what happens. I think loads of people that perform and like people that sing and circus performers I've heard talking about it as well. You know, the idea of like, because you have to have the idea of stepping into that I don't say character, but kind of.
It's like when you're in full performance mode almost and it has to come out, or you have to push it out, or how does it work for you?
It's just they're better at driving that ship, if you must. I think what is happening is that the chimp part of your brain, the chimp kind of behaviour that we have and the human behaviour, it's like the two of them are directly looking at each other in the eye and they're in total sync together and they're getting ready to walk together. And I think that is like kind of the effect of what's happening, rather than most times in life where one's pulling you one way and one's pulling you another way.
And has that happened where the Hooligan has pulled you one way and you want to move another way?
As I said, when the Hooligan's there, I think the both of them are in the right place, you know what I mean? I think for fighting and for situations where it comes to survival, that side of me is what I rely on.
Yeah.
It's what I trust in. And I think a lot of people can do that. Climbers do it. All sorts of athletes do, but they mightn't realise that the idea of this is how I used to feel it. And when I was in the dressing room and I was warming up, when I felt that coming in, I'm like, yes, it's here. I can feel it, you know.
When did you realise that? When did you realise this was an important part of your psyche?
I think a few pages into the book, when I was a kid, I realised that like I had that little part in me that when things got rough, that I got angry, but I got like I'm gonna show these motherfuckers. You know what I mean? In a way, it was more like, rather than getting angry and getting more sad about something, it was like every time something happened, I kind of got a little bit more like I'm going to prove you wrong.
What sort of situations?
I don't know. I think it's like a ginger thing. You know what I mean? It's a stubborn kind of part of you, you know? So a situation where you're going out to fight someone that maybe probably everyone thinks that you're going to lose against. And you're like, wow, how dare you think about me like that?
You know?
And that kind of kicks in, and it's the stubborn part of you, it's the ginger in there, you know, that just will not give in. You know, I've an 11-month-year-old and he has it already, I can see it. Man goes stiff, he does when you try to lift him around, he's like, I'll go nowhere. So he has it already, so he's a young hooligan already.
When you think about the people in your life, there's so many amazing characters written about in Hooligan. Who's the most important person when you look back in your life in terms of forming the person that you are right now?
I know this sounds weird, but probably me. probably me, because I'm the one who put the work in. I'm the one who got over the shit that was going on and got through it, you know? Now, the idea of people that would shape me, there's lots of people. There's lots of people, places. It could be a lot of stuff. It's like, I've described myself in the book as I'm the child that the village raised, if you must. So my Uncle Paul would be a huge part of that. He was the one who, when times did get like where I'd anxiety or I felt something bad was going to happen, he was the one that I confided in. My grandfather taught me so much, taught me about politics, taught me about how to treat people, ethics, street smarts, all of this stuff. My granddad was in the Defence Forces and was part of the battalion that was at Jabberville at that time. So he wasn't actually caught down at Jabberville, but he was on the ground in Congo at the same time.
Right.
So he had been in the Congo and had been away, and for the time, you know, when you go away, I think it's more common for people to go away back then when someone had been away, especially to somewhere like the Congo. Mm. They brought this knowledge with them, you know, and then as a place, Jobstown. I definitely would not be the person I am if I was not raised in Jobstown. I wouldn't change it for the world.
Yeah. So what is it about Jobstown that helped you become the person that you are? You mentioned, I guess you kind of alluded to it there a moment ago, areas of self-defense being the kid who needed that sort of self-resilience. Like, I do wonder, what, did you gain that self-resilience because of where you come from, because of the environment that you grew up in, or was that resilience something that you've already had anyway and it just helped you to thrive better in all areas of your life from going into becoming a UFC fighter as well?
I think looking back at like kind of the line of people in my family, the Houlihan, O'Hooligahane, which is my second name, which means proud man. So that's always been there. That's been the idea of like standing up for what you believe in. But the idea about the being shaped by Jobstown and the self-defense part of it is that I think that we're allowed to become resilient in the place where I grew up, where a lot of kids these days are very sheltered. And if I grew up now, in these days and age, I'd have 10, 20 disorders already kind of like diagnosed on me because of behaviour or because of how I was, or when really sometimes I just needed a kick in the arse. And this is being honest, and I'm telling you that as somebody that I remember acting up sometimes as a kid and knowing that. But now we kind of, now obviously there's so many different things going on and there's so many different more research and all into this stuff, but sometimes I think if you back up, if you reassure the child that it's okay to be like that, you know what I mean? Sometimes it's like, cop on, get yourself together, pick your shoes up, look after yourself, you know, because sometimes it can be like, oh no, he doesn't clean his room because he has some sort of behaviour disorder or something like that. I know, to me, I think sometimes it can be a kick in the ash, you know what I mean? And for me, my personal situation, I think that's where it was. But if I was growing up now, I wouldn't be allowed to be as resilient. Wouldn't be allowed to form that resilience. It takes time, you know. So in my martial arts facility, SPG Dublin 24 on the Green Hills Road, what I do is I literally have an area where people can learn resilience. So kids can be in situations where they have to kind of understand the hard work and ethic is what gets you the skill, you know, that you can't just download it. It doesn't work like that. This insta world that we live in is not really benefiting kids in the idea of learning how to actually navigate life. Because when you go out onto that floor out there, that all of the people are on, and there's all different people and personalities there, and you have to be ready for it. So you have to be learned to, Jobstown gave me the permission and gave me the space to be able to earn that resilience.
That's very interesting. So when people read this book, when I read this book, I'm thinking to myself, it's phenomenal that you've managed to make it in the UFC, to have that level of success, to look back on your life today saying, I've achieved all these things despite what's happened in your childhood, despite being kicked out of home for a little while, having to buy your school uniform one summer for yourself. But what you're actually saying is perhaps what you achieved is because of all of that.
Absolutely. You are giving cards, and the idea is that my cards, I am who I am because of the cards that I was given. Where you get cards and it's a 2 and a 3, oh, this is... Or you can sit there and you can play them cards. And that's exactly what I did in my life. And that's everybody's life. The thing we want to get through from the book is if I can make it, anybody can make it. Now, I say that in the fact of like where some people go, oh, they sound, but they have all of the resources. They have, say, maybe they have the home, so they have two parents together. They have the facilities. They have the area, which is really nice. There's probably no trouble in it and all this kind of stuff, and they have a house and all, but they don't have the resilience. And when it comes into a situation where, say they go into work and somebody's like they robbed their toast or something like that, and they're like, you're bullying me, you robbed my toast. You know, where sometimes it's hard to have the crack these days a little bit more, you know, like I'm very careful where I just have the crack now, because you have the crack and it's like, how dare you say that, you know? Yeah. So it's a little bit lighter in a way, like you can't be like that. You can't be like, I say, when I was growing up, someone would say something to you, but they wouldn't mean what the word would mean, you know what I mean? It's just in the vocabulary in a way, and these days it can shape your whole personality, you know? Like, say, even in politics, if you must, like, it's like, you curse on something, it's like, he cursed on something, that's it, get him out of office. It's like, but it's all right to create homelessness and it's all right to squander money and stuff like that. Where
bigger picture is being lost as well.
Absolutely. Well, like, what are we looking for? Perfect politicians? It's impossible. If we're looking for perfect people, we're never going to find them. And people that are hiding it and saying, like, I am perfect, I'd watch them.
Did you see the clip last week with Barack Obama and the call-out culture line he gave? I'm not sure, does that kind of fall in line with what you, the point you're making there about politics in terms of always looking for a scapegoat rather than looking at what the actual foundation of the problem might be?
I was watching a thing called from Boris Johnson this morning, and there's a girl actually like creasing him because before the Brexit thing, he's like, I'd rather die in a ditch before I ask for an extension on the Brexit. And it's like, can I have an extension, please? And this is the way these guys are. And literally, then the girl says, he says to him, Theresa May said something to him about like his nonsense behaviour. And he said like, no, that wasn't nonsense, my worst nonsense behaviour. He said, but the next time I meet you, I will tell you my worst nonsense behaviour. He says, well, as long as it doesn't get in the way of my politics. I will tell you my nonsense behaviour. So, but that makes no sense to me because it's like, right, so there is things in there you're telling us that would change your opinion of you. And it's like, yeah, I'll tell you the things so your opinion way is still good and you can still vote for me, but I'm actually a slimeball.
Yeah.
That's what you're dealing with. Say, if you look around now, do you see all the election posters up? Have you seen any of these?
Like the posters regarding election that aren't really election posters.
Absolutely. This is a meeting poster. It's like, they're really election posters. So the by-election is coming. And it's like we all said, right, we're going to start the race. Let's all start on this line. And they're like, yeah, I agree. And they're like starting above the line already. They're basically cheating in front of your face. And we have to trust these people to go in now. They're just trying to be like, yeah, well, I get my poster up here and I'll be ahead of you. Your work should be paying for it. Your work should be the thing that's talking for that, you know, the stuff that you're doing on the ground and the people that you're in the community. Like, if you should be able to get elected without putting up posters in that way, you know what I mean? So,
is politics close to what you thought it would be before you stepped in, before you became a Sinn Féin councillor, or is it further away than you possibly imagined?
It's kind of what I thought times 10, you know what I mean? It is exactly, like, there's a lot of NIMBYism. There's a lot of, like, not in my backyard kind of stuff, you know, so... You want to build houses. You want to build social housing in a residential area or in a private housing. Good luck to you, mate. Do you know what I mean? But if you want to build social housing in Jobstown, sound. Don't worry. Everyone will tick all of them boxes. Nobody wants social housing in residential areas. Nobody wants the mixed housing. That's what we need to be doing. We don't should be doing. Like what just happened with Devney Gardens just there is ridiculous. Devney Gardens is the Irish people's land, and we're literally selling it off now to developers. The situation got voted off yesterday. There's people literally standing there inside the council screaming, do not sell the land. There's people running in, getting taken out by guard, and they're like, don't mind that, nothing to see here. Clean it to the side, Delhi, there you go, developer. That's what's happening. That's really what's happening. Affordable housing. Do you know how much affordable housing is?
As in, to give you a figure?
Give me a figure. What would you call it for? What could you afford as affordable housing?
Well, I can tell you that affordable housing is probably not within the remit. The remit of, like, speaking of somebody who's moved to Dublin rather than somebody who's been brought up in Dublin is something that's kind of like a terrifying prospect, yeah. Affordable housing. And then you get into the idea of what affordable housing is to actually own. And then that's just, it's not even a terrifying idea, it's just an impossible idea. So
impossible idea.
To put a figure on that, I'm not even quite sure, to be quite honest with you.
Affordable housing in Ireland now is €309,000.
But that's the definition in inverted commas of what
You couldn't get a loan of €309,000. Like if I went in, and what I'm earning, what you're earning, we couple up, let's get married. We wouldn't get a mortgage.
you'd need a kind of a three-way marriage or a four-way marriage.
You need to have exactly what you're saying there, yeah. And you're dead right. But that's it's not affordable housing. Affordable housing is something that you can afford to buy a house and then you can live as well.
Yeah.
That's affordable.
There's a lot in your career I want to chat about, in your Friday career I want to chat about. Just before that, like what would you change? Decide, yes, this is one of the vocations I want to pursue in terms of politics. Was there a specific thing that you were like, after a couple of years or a couple of decades or however long it could take me, I want to change this thing? Do you have that one thing that you want to change?
In politics or in my fighting career?
In your politics.
All right, touch on fighting career.
We'll get to that in a moment.
All right, I would like it just to make sense.
Okay.
I think anyone would like it to make sense. I think when someone's getting out of bed at 9 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock in the morning and they're going to work and they're working 5 days a week and they're just working their ass off and at the end of it they just have nothing to say. They're just giving it all out. It just doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense to them people. It doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't make sense that the rents are the highest in Europe. It doesn't make sense that this country is the fastest growing economy in Europe, but it's the least development. It's not developing. Everything's getting worse. Like, our homelessness has gone down, or gone up every single month. If this was your job, right, on this show here, and your numbers were going down every single month, what happened?
Yeah, there'd be a change of personnel,
yeah,
probably.
Sacked. That's just the way it is. I said a good thing at the book launch. Picture this as like a toilet in a garage, right? The whole country, just to make it easier to understand. And we go in, and there's just shit everywhere. The place is in bits, right? And what do you do? You check the list on the wall of who was supposed to clean the toilet last. And if you check that, and it's the Irish country, it's Ireland. It says Fianna Fáil, Fianna Gael, Fianna Fáil, Fianna Gael, Fianna Fáil, Fianna Gael. So we know what's going on. We have landed here for a reason, because of bad management. We've been managed bad for a long, long time. These guys know what's going on. They're not stupid. Like, they're trying to make everybody happy, but make as much profit as possible. And that's not the way a country should be ran. A country is not a business like that, you know? And they treat it like a business. They'll talk about the economic growth, but they won't talk about the economic development. And they won't show you the graph for that either. And I'm sure if you see it, you'll know what's really going down. You know, the economic growth one goes like this for Ireland. And it's like, no, it's all good, no money. But the economic development one is going like this. And that's the only one that matters, because the one that matters to me, and it matters to you, and it matters to everybody else. That's the schools, that's the workers, that's the hospitals. Like the nurses say, when the nurses went on strike, that was a massive thing. Guess what they got out of that?
Tiny pay increase.
They didn't ask for a pay increase, they asked for a pay restoration.
Yeah.
So even the money that was taken away from them when they ruined the country, come back, we could go all day here.
We could. It's probably a conversation that we could have another day as well. There's so much in the book I want to get
Absolutely.
To as well, Paddy.
Let's do it.
And actually,
let's do it.
One of the things, and it's one of the stark lines, I think, at the end of one of the chapters, is not sure if I can keep them in any longer. That's in revealing darker moments in your life and in relation to your childhood. What are these moments? What are these things that you struggled to talk about in the past and you are now able to articulate now?
I'm a man now, so I think when I turned 18, I thought I was a man. I'm a man now, where the idea is I understand that I can forgive people now, do you know what I mean? I can understand the idea of situations, where when you're growing up, it's like someone does something and you're like, you fucker, you know, you did that on me. And then after a little while, you can kind of look at their situation and try to read it from their side and make some reconciliation with it, you know. And I think I can do that now, and that's why, to be able to get it off my chest. And even if someone's like, I can't believe you said that, or I can't believe this, like...
What are the things that you've been carrying with you?
There's a lot of explanations in the book that people would ask me questions about. There's, regarding growing up, people would ask me questions about my childhood, and you just wouldn't have it sorted out in your head yet. With the book, I was able to timeline that stuff, you know. Like, and I never really got into it. Everyone knew that I have like had a past as a kid. People that I grew up with. I actually got a message off a guy that I grew up with this morning. He's like, "Holy shit, Paddy! I can't remember that it was that bad."
Right.
He says, "But now reading it, he's like it makes a lot of sense now." You know what I mean? And it does, because he said, "Look, I must have blocked it out."
Like, that's a fascinating thing to say, because I often wonder as well the timeline of perhaps your appreciation of certain things in your life. I mean, like, your relationship with your mother is something fascinating that occurs throughout the book, and it's obviously something that gets better over time. But at the very start, you illustrate her own background, somebody who's in a Magdalene laundry. Mm-hmm. Like, at what age do you realise that was not only a part of her life, but a part of somebody's life that can destroy somebody mentally for their entire life, and ultimately their child or their grandkids can suffer as a result?
This brings me back to politics, right? Because that situation was a government situation as well, and probably the same one that's creating the one in our country now at the same time. Now, my mother would be a byproduct of that, and many others across the country would be. Now, people would look at my mother, say, moving into a council house, be like, oh, your council house, you got a free house and all of this stuff. And, like, my mother, I look at it longer than that, okay? So people would look at now social housing and this, and they would kind of look down on it a little bit. I'm looking at this in the longer terms. In 20 years, 30 years, what are them great people going to produce? My mother produced me. From a council house in a single parent household. So there would have been a time where she would have been shamed as a single mother, an unmarried mother in this country. They were shamed and pushed into corners. And that's just the reality of life. People don't get on and things happen. But Now we're in a situation where we're going to be you're going to be asking someone else this question in a few years about the hotels. When them kids are grown up and now they're raising children and they're telling their own children the story of, like, I grew up in a hotel for the first 3 years of my life because there was no houses in the country. And there was no, you know, and now Paddy Houlihan's the president of the country, the houses are here and my grand. I'm only messing. But that's the truth, you know. We're going into a process now where it's going to happen again. We're going to happen again. So I am the byproduct of my mother. I understand my mother's life now. I understand that she's more powerful than more people than I know, to be able to overcome the stuff that she overcame and to be able to raise me. And not only that, but she does things where I don't know. Like, my mum would be, I think she'd be ignoring me one time, but she wouldn't. She just would not be having that argument at the time. And I'd be like, say something. She'd be like, it's grand. Just do your best. Just do your best. And that's the advice I give to people now. Like, my mum would say to me when I was going to fight, be like, say something to me, like, hug me, can you love me or something?
What was her view of fighting and your career when it started to take off? Because you said that the first moment she said she was proud of you was when you got elected. Yeah. So what was her view of the fighting career?
The first time, my mum would have told me she was proud of me, but the first time I ever felt she was proud of me is when I was elected.
Right.
You know, because to me, this is where I kind of learned this view as well. My mother would look at people, say, my mother would, growing up, would look at doctors and look at, like, TDs and counsellors and stuff like this as like good people, the people that had made it, the people that you aspire to be, in a way. So when I was going to be a fighter, I don't think she was too excited about the idea of that. And then the idea of, like, your son is a fighter.
Yeah.
That's not, when you look at it like that as well, it's like, it's not probably the aspiration you have for your child when he's growing up. Yeah. She doesn't understand, she didn't understand it. But then when I became elected, in her mind, I had came into that situation, I think, where she was like, all right, now he has a real job, if you must.
Like, there's also the practical element of it all. She was the person who kept your life machine on when you had life-saving surgery, when a doctor told her to turn it off.
Mm-hmm.
This is somebody who knew exactly, acutely, what you were going through in terms of the very rare blood condition that ultimately did end your fighting career, that would have ended it at any point. So I presume that would have made it even harder for her to watch you get into a cage at any point, knowing what was going on biologically for you.
My mother came and watched, I think it was one fight, my first ever fight in Shore Road, and then she never came again. She never came again. She just, as I said, I just, even the idea of having her there was, there's an anxiety in that as well, you know, like your mother's there, whether you're a man or whether you're a man or a child, it's just the way it is. And she supported me in my career, but I don't think she ever seen it. I don't think she would have stood it. That's being up straight. My mother's a very simple woman, and she didn't understand it, I don't think, you know. But she's stronger than most people that I know, because she's clever in a way that, like, doesn't come across as clever. You know, it comes across as, like, it just doesn't want to get involved, that's quiet. And sometimes she's just, being quiet is a good answer, you know.
Mm. Would you say you were an emotional fighter?
An emotional fighter?
Yeah.
Define emotion. What do you mean?
Angry. No. What, wanting to not only defeat an opponent, defeat a man at the opposite end of the cage?
No, I was fighting myself, yeah, most of the time, you know what I mean? It was me against me in there, when I'm looking in that mirror and stuff like that. Now, the opponent obviously matters and stuff, but the emotion part with me, wasn't it? It was pure bliss for me. It was just, it was like Elysium, the thing that Maximus talks about. It was a beautiful thing to me, you know, walking out, the idea of feeling the energy of the crowd. I couldn't think of, like, anger or I would say nerves is not as an emotion. Nerves is like a reaction to a situation that you're putting your body into, and to go through that. And anyway, that's the decision. If I put you in the tree arena, you'll feel the exact same way I feel.
I was just about to say, that's my lack of understanding, referring to emotion as anger automatically, yeah, which is a very, very different thing. That's the first thing that comes to my mind when you ask me what emotion is. But actually, it's very different. Like you say in the book, that being an emotional fighter is a very dangerous thing.
Yeah.
But separately to that, there is this almost spiritual feeling, I think, from reading your book, that you get, that isn't the same as being fired up emotionally, overly emotionally.
No, I'm into it. Like, I'm into it in a spiritual way. You know what I mean? When someone's hitting me and I'm like, I'm taking it, I like it. You know what I mean? I like it. Now, I'm nervous going there.
Yeah.
But you would be as well. If we put you and me in the same situations, the difference between me and you would be how we react to them feelings, how we succumb to them feelings. If you're oh, no, I can't do it because of this, then you won't do it. Where to me, I was the opposite. I was like, no, I can do it because of this.
And do you think that your emotional reaction is similar to other fighters that you would have grown up with, trained with? Do you think you were like a sponge and you all shared that same sort of mentality?
The one thing I've known about that, and which has helped me in my coaching career, I've been coaching for probably over 10 years now, is that, listen, I'm still only learning about this. Everyone's different. We're all different. If you do one job that fixes all, won't work. That's why I think having too many fighters, too many people to look after can hinder that as well, because you've got to deal with people on a one-to-one basis on the emotional side of it. And the emotional side of it is the biggest part of it. Skills is a huge part. But listen, you'll get fighters that don't have skills but have wills, and they will go in and beat a fighter with skills. Sometimes you'll get fighters that's the best skill going, he's talented, but then he can't get it from the dressing room to the fight. And that's it. Gustav Matos used to say, the man that gets beat, it's not the man that gets beat by the better opponent that matters, it's the opponent, or the man that beats himself. And that's it. That happens in the dressing room.
Yeah.
People beat themselves, even good fighters.
But like that's what I was just about to ask, actually, about that dressing room environment, about that training environment, really. Like, somebody you speak about at length in the book is John Kavanagh, and how he's such a brilliant technical coach, and being prepared physically, if you had John Kavanagh in your corner, you are sorted. But then perhaps if things start to go wrong, when you do get that first, when you're always gone, basically, when you start to get that defeat, that perhaps the emotional backup that he would give as a human being was potentially lacking. Is that fair to say?
If you win or if you lose, it was only after a little while that I started to realise that didn't really affect John how it affected me. I'm with that at home, you know. Now, and I understand that as a coach now as well. But the idea of that, is you have to understand it. So to me, if we had lost, John was not feeling what I was feeling. You know, like when my fighters lose, like it gets me. You know what I mean? And if you look at it, you'll see on my face there and then. I don't know if John's just, if he's better at it or if he's not as good at it. One or the other, you know what I mean? But technically, really, really good. But emotionally dealing with you on an emotional level, being able to deal with problems with you, being able to talk to you face to face and kind of overcome stuff, no.
It seemed that as your career went further down the path, there was a situation, like there's obviously this very famous fight where he's on the phone in the build-up to it. I know he's trying to get somebody in and he has other things to worry about, but he's not focused on you in the build-up. Is that just the case where over the years perhaps he had more trust in you and that you actually, he didn't realise what you needed pre-fight, or why do you think that happened?
I think John knew exactly what I needed pre-fight. I think he knew that. He's good at the idea of figuring out different personalities, if you must, and what kind of engages them in that way. But the fact of that is that if you read John's book, it's a different account of how that went. And I didn't like that. That kind of annoyed me a little bit, you know what I mean? If you look at John's book, the account of that fight and how the build-up is that...
Louis Smolka.
Yeah, John didn't take really much responsibility for that. I was taking the responsibility for it, and I kind of wrote what actually happened in that situation.
You said he got overwhelmed?
Said I got overwhelmed, and that there was a seed of doubt, and that there was it was the main event fight. It all came on me. There was no like mention of that. And it just came, and that John wasn't the one coming to me saying that I was main event. Twitter had said it to me.
What happens after your fighting career, your relationship with John, in terms of going into business with him?
I don't have any relationship with John now. I have zero relationship with him, unfortunately. It was like kind of, I had John's back at one time and John didn't have mine when it came to it. And that was kind of the situation.
How do you mean by that, just for people who haven't read the book?
Well, we'd announced the gym. We'd announced a gym together that we were going to open a gym in Talla, and then time had went on. We were looking for a building for a long time. John ended up getting contacted by an investor, and an investor ended up jumping onto the project, and I was kind of hazy about it, you know. And then it turned out in a situation that I was being changed from Paddy Houlihan, the UFC fighter, to a coach. So I was kind of getting ground down a little bit to be a coach, and I wasn't standing in a building in Talla taking orders off some guy that literally knew nothing about mixed martial arts. I had said it to John many times, this is mentally like killing me, you know. I had just lost my career, and now I was sitting here being told what to do by some guy that was a fan of the sport, basically. John didn't have my back on that, so a kind of situation where he'd promised, I'd do this, we'll do that, and then nothing happened. And for my own sake and the sake of my family, sake of my kids, sake of the future of my kids and my livelihood, I had to leave. And then I ended up having to go back to a community centre. So I went back to the community centre, and I had 200 people left the gym with me. I was like, right, I've got 200 people now looking the trail.
Yeah.
So we went to a community centre, I went and rented a building, I taught in that community centre for the weeks, and through all of this, John didn't ring me, John didn't drop up to the community centre to see was I okay or anything like that. John was doing his own thing, and I know John's a busy man, but I gave him 10 years, so I think I deserve that, you know.
When was the last time you guys spoke?
Can't remember. I was actually over a situation that occurred, but it was by text and by phone. There's no relationship there, and I think he said on Ariel Helwani when he said, sure, with this relationship, it's just the way it is. Sometimes, listen, and I'm figuring this out even more as well, sometimes you can go 10 years with somebody, and it does that, but you either get swallowed up by that, or you just keep going the way you're going, and that's what I'm doing, and that's what I have been doing since I retired.
For anyone who hasn't read the book, there is tons more detail on that in Hooligan and everything else we spoke about. It's brilliant, Paddy. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
OTB AM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
Paddy Hooligan there in conversation with me yesterday afternoon. You can catch the full thing back on youtube.com/offtheball, and it will be available on the OTB AM podcast a little bit later on as well. Just some breaking news. Saracens have not shown up for the launch of the Heineken Champions Cup this morning. There is Neil Tracy in Cardiff. No sign of the champions, he says. And EPCR have released a statement saying they're disappointed to learn of Saracens' decision to make their club representatives unavailable for today's official 2019-20 season launch of the Heineken Champions Cup and Challenge Cup in Cardiff. EPCR will now consider what action is appropriate in this instance and will be making no further comment at this time. That is it from us this morning on OTB AM. It is 31 minutes past 9 on this Wednesday morning. You can stay tuned to the Off The Ball channels and OTB Sports Radio throughout the day. And if you've missed anything from OTB AM this morning, you've got the Paddy Hoolan interview, you've got the sports pages with Johnny Ward and Champions League with Kenny Cunningham. You can catch the podcast back on offtheball.com/podcasts or on the Go Loud app. And you can watch it back as well on our YouTube channel, and make sure to click subscribe there as well for all our latest videos. Tonight on Off The Ball, Champions League with Damien Delaney, Wednesday night rugby, and much, much more besides. We'll see you tomorrow morning on OTB AM at 7:30. Bye-bye for now.
That was an Off The Ball Podcast Network presentation.